I know.
Yeah. Good. Nice. Good morning and welcome to the regular commission meeting of Chelan County PUD. With me in the boardroom today are three commissioners and on the phone, Steve McKenna. And Randy Smith will not be available today as our fifth commissioner, but we do have a quorum, so business will take place. April 2nd, 2018. Welcome to everyone at the head table is our attorney, Eric Walquist, Rebecca Garfine, the clerk, and general manager, Steve Wright. And we'll open in a minute or so with Irene Godfrey and our Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute. I'd like to encourage people who are interested to speak to the commission with an approximate 3 to 5 minute time limitation. And we'd like you to give your full name and your residential address. We'll provide time for you. Anything else before we go to the opening? Oh, yes, thank you. Cell phones, please put those in a position where it will not disturb the meeting. And no attempt at humor today in terms of what happens to you if you violate that. with all that being said, and thank you, Steve, for that, Irene Godfrey, please.
I'm Irene Godfrey, and I work in finance. And my fifth topic is related to the National Public Health Week, which is this week, and it's water safety, as in drinking water. And for example, you may be going hiking, and you don't want to carry a ton of water with you, so you want to be able to purify your water. Or if you're going traveling, you want to have safe water. So you have several options. You can boil your water. You can use the water pump. Or chemicals, or I brought it to Sheraton. And this is actually definitely the easiest and quickest way. And all you have to do is take it out and you turn it on, stir the water up for 90 seconds if it's an outlet, one of those big Nalgene bottles, or less than a minute for, say, you have 15 ounces of glass of water at a hotel or at a restaurant. And it works by an ultraviolet bulb, and it actually works on the DNA of the bad things, including viruses, so it allows them, it disallows them from reproducing. So, and finally, it's a good thing to have in your home emergency kit. So, and you can get these locally.
I have a question. So it disrupts the DNA, the reproduction. Does it kill the virus?
I don't think it actually kills it. Just renders them.
So they can't reproduce, but can they still make you sick?
I don't think I printed everything out, but
you know what? That's all right. We'll look at it later.
Yeah. It's we've used it and we haven't gotten sick yet. So, and it's a lot. It's very convenient, and you can buy much smaller. You can buy one that's half the size, and it's less than 3 ounces, and it'll do a glass of water less than a minute.
I know some people on Lake Chelan are buying really large units and putting them. And using that to, to clean the water, sterilize the water through their whole system coming out of the lake.
Oh, and I know municipalities use ultraviolet to clean the water.
Yeah.
Irene, I have to tell you that this is a topic that is very close and dear to my heart. I've been working on a clean water purification system for a small village in Haiti called Milo for many years now. And I've seen firsthand what bad water does to people and how it debilitates not just an individual but families and entire civilizations. And we take it for granted that we can drink water out of our tap most places here in the United States and not have a fear or a concern. And it's been a real eye-opening thing for me. We're using similar type filtration systems that will clean down to 1 and 2 microns, 2 microns for surgical procedures. in Haiti. And so it really is a very serious topic, and we can't take it too seriously. So thank you for your presentation today.
Yeah. In spur of thought, both foreign and domestic, sometimes there are roadside stands that have bottles of water for sale, and people think because it's a bottled water that it's clean. One of the things that's happening is old water bottles are collected and filled with water, and then a little bit of super glue on the lid so that when you crack it, it feels like it's sealed, and it's a used container. And it's very cheap and spreading.
I have read about that. Even though you think you're getting good water, contaminated. So apparently, I've never tried this, but you can even use it, put this in a water bottle.
Yeah.
Turn it upside down, take it around.
Yeah. Some friends of ours spent 2 unplanned days in a motel recovering intestinally. From bottled waters that they bought at a roadside stand domestically. So, yeah, it is. Going to run the vacation plans. Thank you very much. Very appropriate. Let's take a look at our agenda, please. We are looking at the approval of the agenda. Any items that are subject to transfer that you'd like to change or appear differently?
Mr. Chairman, I would like consideration of moving agenda items, resolution items 12 and 15 to the consent agenda.
Commissioners, your thoughts?
I'm just looking. I'm looking for one. Isn't there one a sole source? Isn't that one of these a sole source resolution?
There's not a sole source resolution on the.
That's fine.
In agreement. Commissioner McKenna, any change? Not hearing any objections, we'll move items 12 and 15 to the consent agenda. So, number 3, customer service satisfaction survey, and I'll turn that over to General Manager Steve Wright.
So recall that every 2 years we go through the exercise of surveying our customers to see how well we're doing, particularly with respect to the item that is the top of our balanced scorecard, customer satisfaction, most important thing we do. And so I want to welcome Robinson Research today, who is here to provide the results of the survey.
Thank you.
Well, good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. With me is Bill Robinson and Suzanne Hartman. As Steve mentioned, every other year we have been doing the customer satisfaction survey. So we started this probably in January, looking at the questions, updating a few topical questions for the time. And Suzanne and I worked together with, of course, Steve and hired Bill to go out, and Bill, I think he's probably spent about a month in the field conducting the survey, and here we are today with the results.
Thank you, John. This is unfiltered Wenatchee tap water. I feel safe. what do I start with? I've been doing this since the mid-80s. I've done at least a dozen utility studies a year since the 80s. This is the most favorable utility customer satisfaction survey I have ever done.
All right. Thank you very much. We're good.
There's no seamy underbelly to this. It's really all good.
Nice.
Okay. We did 402 interviews. The reason for a strange number like that is kind of hard to stop when you have a bunch of people on the phones and you want a couple extras in case you see something, you know, like a 19-year-old with a PhD or something that's implausible. And so we just ended up with 402. We did it in February 21st to March 3rd. We were on the phones. 20% self-identified as Hispanic. That falls at 9% if we just take them as they come. I know the population's higher than that, but a lot of Hispanics have like burner phones and so forth, or we're in an unusual time for surveying Hispanics. Everyone wants to do it, but a lot of them are just ducking. There's a real lack of trust for talking to strangers on the phone or something. And so we had to force it from 9 to 20%. Margin of error, plus or minus 5%. That's for a two-horned question where half said yes or half said no. You can't just look at any number and say I'm plus or minus 5%. But if you get a hold of John or Suzanne about anything where you want to look at, hey, how closely can I trust these numbers, we can take a look at it in a heartbeat. On a question-by-question basis, we can tell you what you need to know. There were four positive descriptors: a utility you can trust, good corporate citizen, good environmental steward, well-managed. Those are the ones that we tested, and all were above 4.5 on a five-point scale, which is really good. And then there were three positive areas of expectations, and again, those were all above 4.5, so it's that's excellent. Overall satisfaction, the blue line is your 2018 there, and it's, you know, it's a higher mean than the others. I'm really surprised to see, it was really high before, and so you've got to be doing something right. Reliability, look at those reliability numbers of 86% at the top of the scale. That's good for you. It's not good for me because I can't do much analysis with those stubby little columns off on all the other places. It's so clustered in the very satisfied category, it doesn't really even support analysis, which is good. Quality of communication. Everybody hates communication. And all surveys that people complain about the communication and organizations and so forth. And so this is just amazing that communication would be that high. I know I'm working for the communication people. I'm singing for myself, but no, they're real numbers.
And your survey will be accepted humbly by the staff, I'm thinking. Yeah.
quite possibly. Communication, specific topics, outages, offering ways to manage your account, providing ways to save money on electric bills and become more energy efficient, and PUD finances. They don't know anything about the PUD finances, so it's kind of a stab there that never overestimate the public's knowledge about the workings of any utility. This is an agree-disagree, these descriptors, a utility you can trust. That's the one you want to be your longest bar, and it is. Good corporate citizen, environmental steward, those are really important things. I mean, those are what we call drivers of image. And then well-managed, and again, they're just not sure how well-managed you are. They don't, you know, they meet the people in the lobby, and they meet the linemen and so forth, but they don't really get to see very much about the inner management. This is one about whether it exceeds or falls short of your expectations or exceeds your expectations. When I call AT&T Cellular, I expect them to put me on hold for an hour and abuse me. So be careful about expectations. That sometimes, I mean, we mean it in a positive way, and we help them with this, and their expectations were positive. It was, we didn't talk to people that said, well, I expect them to abuse me, but these are great. As an individual with respect, responsive to customer needs, employees are experienced, knowledgeable, and proactive. So we have two similar things. One's about consolidating facilities in the Wenatchee operations. We asked everyone, not just Wenatchee people, about, you know, how they would like to be get input. Now, direct mail tops the charts, but direct mail has that quality of it's easy to throw in the garbage and ignore, and you don't have to tell somebody you don't have time right now or whatever. So sometimes direct mail gets a unnatural bump from the fact that it's so easy to dodge or ignore put somewhere and never get around to it. So you always want to take direct mail with a grain of salt. It's a good thing to include in utility messages and so forth, bill stuffers and whatnot, but just it's don't see it as a panacea. We have a community meeting open to the public, and then down at the bottom, an in-person discussion among 10 randomly selected customers. Those would seem similar, but they're worlds apart. A meeting that's open to everyone. You get people who care. They have strong opinions. Sometimes they have a piece of real estate they're hoping to sell with, you know, whatever's going down there. Sometimes we have to hose down these processes with, you know, camcorders and make a documentary that shows that our client didn't just do this in an ivory tower. It's hard to find people that are really just regular citizens, you know, that aiming the camera. It's hard work in those because usually there are people that obviously have an axe to grind. It's a good thing to do if it's something that's always a hot topic. I attended a seminar by a guy who ran the Astrodome, taking all the refugees from New Orleans and the big hurricane, and he said that if you convene a mob that you expect to be angry, you deserve to be tarred and feathered. So that's just something to always keep in mind, whether you're just going to open the doors, and because you can get something, you know, disproportionately, some group that you never even imagined existed, you know, like I remember in your relicensing, hang gliders came all over from the west side. All of a sudden, you'd think that every other person, here's a hang glider just because busloads of them came in to quit saw the process. So be aware of that. Email feedback, of course, that's more popular among younger people. Telephone survey right in the middle. Ongoing online discussion. And then the least favorite was what we would call a focus group or a listening session. This is the same thing, only pertains to the strategic plan, the five-year plan. The numbers are almost the same. They're in the same sequence and everything. So if you saw that previous one, you've seen this. Underground lines cost 2 to 10 times as much as overhead lines. How would you recommend the PUD respond to the underground request? So I tried to tighten this. Well, come on, what is it, 2 or 10? But John has a bunch of national stats and everything on it, so we're tucking in so we can compare us to another index. So 2 to 10 is the way they said it, so that's the way we say it too. But you can see roughly 2 to 1, those who would benefit from the undergrounding would pay the cost. So let's just spread it all equally among us. Average respondent was 53.8 years old. That's about 3 years younger than a normal study of adults in an area like this. So I know it sounds old, but, you know, because we look at this census. Yes, you're right. I'm 13 years older than that. But the census includes babies and everything, so something like 57 is a good number. We came in a little younger. We have to force that to keep it from getting too old, or we'll end up with so many people that are 75 and up just because they are more willing to take the surveys that we have to force that a bit. 76% reported owning their own homes. Average person had 3 years of college. Typical person had been a PUD customer for 29 years. 76% said they were full-time residents, not snowbirds. We forced the gender quota too because men are guarding that TV remote while the women answer the phone. So we have to apply a little Kentucky windage to get some balance there. Back up and see if I can do it. Ooh, look at that. Okay, 71% were cell phones this time. We're seeing more and more cell phones. We're also seeing more and more people listing their cell phone as their listed line with their utility or whatever, because it's the phone they've got, and if there's some reason you want to get a hold of them, you know, that's the same with voters and everything. I mean, they predicted we'd go out of business because of cell phones. You know, the whole industry would fold, but that hasn't been true at all. But, you know, it's not just listed numbers, and cell phones are coming up. It varies wildly from county to county. You can't say anything just kind of overall about cell phones in general. I can show you two counties that are adjacent to each other, and one survey was overwhelmingly landline, the other was overwhelmingly phone, or overwhelmingly cell. Like college towns, they move, they take their cell phones with them, but their phone number is still back home where their parents live. So it could be tricky. But 70%, this is self-identified, 70% white Caucasian, 20% Hispanic. Again, we'd force that. Usually we have a 2% or something Native American, African American. We had a bigger refused on the ethnicity this time than we usually get, which doesn't surprise me. Those are sensitive topics these days. They asked us to take a look specifically at those who self-identified as Hispanic. There are far more points of unanimity than there are points of differentiation. When you go through, you really have to look for anything where Hispanics are above. They tended to be slightly more interested in receiving all these forms of information than did their non-Hispanic counterparts. They averaged 20 years younger than the people who identified as not Hispanic, and they'd been a customer 13 years shorter than their counterparts. And they were much more likely to consider themselves full-time residents than the non-Hispanic customers. So I know a lot of us have this vision of this migration of all these people following crops and things like that. But the Hispanics that we talk to here seem to be very well anchored and full-time residents. They were much more likely to take the survey on a cell phone than their non-Hispanic counterparts. Hispanics are more likely to have cell phones. They're also more likely to have burner phones. And so it's really hard to get a good representation of them because the burner phones don't show up. Smartphones show up on all kinds of lists, but burner phones come and go. So it's one of the challenges we face. We were half Wenatchee and half everything else. These are identical to the last wave and, you know, within a point or two, a percent or two of the one before that. So we like nice consistency in sampling. Oh, by the way, we sample very accurately. We don't apply weighting schemes to shim things up. But every number is a real number, and I'm a simple guy, and I like to keep it simple. A few recommendations. This first one I recycled straight up from the last one. Don't expect them to improve every year. I expected to come here and say, hey, they were already great, and they're great this time. So, no, they got greater somehow. And I really believe you're satisfying nearly everyone who's capable of being satisfied. Not everyone wants to be satisfied. We all know people that want to have some kind of a negative experience at anything they do so they can complain how they were abused. And I think you're really satisfying just about everybody that wants to be. In the next replication of it, there's a few questions I would split a little bit. We're measuring more than one attribute in one question. I like those out so that they're just easy to see. Be mindful of the fact that your Hispanic customers that appear on your lists with working phone numbers may not be typical of the overall Hispanic community in Chelan County. That a lot of these people, they're more likely to be renters than are their non-Hispanic counterparts and so forth. And so you're getting some kind of a somewhat atypical sampling of your Hispanic community, and that's just the way it is. And in almost every way you can imagine, their opinions and perceptions are indistinguishable from those of non-Hispanics. That's it. Boy, do they look good. You folks are doing fabulously.
Yes.
Is there a certain time of day that you would make your inquiries?
Yes. Scientific telephone sampling requires that you burn through as little sample as possible. Once we seize on a phone number, you know, we're like wolves picking out a caribou and don't give up. And even if others run in front of you. If it's a no answer, a busy signal, yeah, that's my mom, she's not here right now, anything other than no, we're not going to talk to you, don't ever call me again, we make up to 5 attempts over the course of about 5 days, and then we pay attention. We start out evenings and weekend. A typical shift is 4 to 9 Monday through Thursday. We take Fridays off because Fridays are just bad days to talk to anybody. And then we work Saturday 10 to 6, off on Sunday, and that's the routine. We start with that, and then if they're not available or whatever, then we go back and we try different times of day, days of the week, and so forth. So by the time we make our 5 tries before we give up, we've tried all the different times of day and days of the week and so forth. That's one of the reasons that it takes so long. I mean, you see surveys where they talk to 2,000 people in one night. Well, those are not representative. The first 2,000 people that will talk to you are not typical, and then they shim it up with a waiting scheme. We take our time and do it this way. Thank you.
I'd just like to add a comment. One of the things that I found encouraging, although Bill mentioned that people don't like the small groups necessarily. There were 114 people that were willing to give us their names and for further contact on either our strategic plan or our strategic facilities. So that's good for looking at the process we used last time where we had topic teams, and maybe we have some folks to recruit from for that.
So that's 100 plus of the 402 that
responded. Correct. 114 of the 402 said they'd be willing.
Thank you.
We also receive quite a wealth of verbatim comments at the end. So they're always interesting to read through. We always try and see if there's themes or things that stand out. So, again, it's really interesting to read those. A lot of them are really positive. But, again, we go through, and I know other folks do, and just take a hard look at those as well.
And we still hear that the rates are too high.
Yeah. That one always surprises me, but it's true. Mr. McKenna, any comments or thoughts?
No, great data. Good information again, and congratulations to staff once again.
Ann? Good. Gary?
This is a reflection of staff and staff's efforts.
Yep.
And fantastic job. Real kudos to staff.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I always notice a really friendly lobby when I come in, but it's a really nice, welcome, warm environment. Some utilities, they're to be bulletproof and robbery proof. It's sort of like you check into a cheap hotel on South 99. Where you've got to put your money down under a tunnel on the other side, and they've got an inch thick polycarbonate between you and a speaker and stuff, and that's hard on perceptions of customer service. That calling on the phone and walking into the lobby are both just like perfect to me.
Nice,
good feedback.
Really good.
Thanks.
To hear.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. Item 4.
Recall that we have initiated a quarterly update on electric load growth in the county, and this will be the second in that series. I encourage the board to be thinking about the information that's being provided and whether it's useful in meeting your needs and things that you might consider asking us to do if you'd like us to do something different to make it a better experience.
Good morning, Commissioners. Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service, and Chad Rissman, Director of Distribution Asset Management. So I know you've got a really busy schedule this morning, so we'll keep this presentation down to an hour and a half, I think. So. Okay, we'll actually move through it pretty quickly, but certainly if you have questions and comments, we can do that during the presentation or at the end. Essentially, this is the second of a quarterly update with a focus on electrical loads throughout our county. We're going to talk primarily about what we're doing with the municipalities and the county as far as furthering our discussions with energy planning. We'll give you a quick update on the status of our cryptocurrency loads since we've adopted the moratorium a few weeks back. And we will provide a summary of overall electric load forecasts and some of our load forecasting efforts. We'll talk about some of the next steps and answer any questions that you have. So specifically with the municipalities, we've spent some time. We did meet all of the county and the municipal groups, either went to the commission meetings or their city council meetings. And had very open, transparent dialogue about the challenges that we're seeing with our energy loads, particularly with the high-density load or cryptocurrency load requests in addition to the organic growth. So we really think we did a good job of opening their eyes to the challenges that we face and inviting participation on a move-forward basis to try to work that out together. Of course, there was a lot of interest in the cryptocurrency mining, and as you know, some of them took action to put in moratoriums or interim controls, which was very helpful for the cause. Our specific objectives that we wanted to try to achieve and what we want to try to achieve on a move-forward basis is essentially a joint agency planning with a focus on electrical infrastructure, but not limited to electrical infrastructure. It certainly will include our fiber optics and our district's water and wastewater services as they need to be incorporated in there. We're looking for this longer-term view of utility infrastructure. Of course, the immediate needs as well as looking 30 years beyond. That was one of the major feedbacks that we've gotten from our customer constituent groups is, look, we'd like to see the PD planning much longer than just the immediate 3 to 5 years. So one of those efforts also is to understand our current state of the electric infrastructure and what limitations we have. Then we want to recalibrate with the municipalities and the county on land use zoning, how they anticipate to use lands from a zoning perspective, and you know, kind of frame up or form up a comprehensive plan on those zones. I think from that point, then, we can start incorporating energy use consumption into the revised land use planning. I think it's important to recognize that we want to reestablish kind of the baseline of what our electrical infrastructure looks like today and what the zoning looks like today. And then beyond that, the municipalities, the county, the groups can ask, how much HDL do they want, and how do they zone those? It's very clear to us that it's very unclear to the municipalities and the county how they want to deal with HDL from a zoning perspective. And I think this slide here really kind of gets at that. It's a triangular shape for a reason, and if you look at that down at the bottom of the slide, you know, open space and recreational urban space, limited single-family home, these, from a zoning perspective, these use the least amount of energy. And as you move up the triangular shape through the multifamily housing, commercial, retail, semi-industrial, large industrial, you know, the width is representative of the more energy use in that model. And this is essentially the ground zero for zoning and planning for electrical use. But when you bring the cryptocurrency mining on top of it, you can see that the energy use per square foot per year from a demand standpoint is massive in compared to traditional zoning and planning for energy. And so that's the big challenge here, is that we baseline what we have with the municipalities without HDL and understand our gaps and our challenges. And then we look at some planning with the cryptocurrency miner there. So the questions on the side, you know, how much HDL do we plan for? Where do we zone this? Do we centralize it or decentralize it? Decentralizing meaning incorporating HDL loads in all of the sections in the lower half of the triangle, or do you zone those in specific areas? And over what time period would we incorporate those? So those are the major challenges that we're looking at. Those are the major questions we're trying to solve by this collaborative joint planning. So moving on, we've seen this in our first quarterly update, and of course, 3 months into the year, we've recalibrated that. So this is kind of that 3-year look ahead. Again, this doesn't necessarily translate into energy. This is more of a peak demand. So these are specific customer class areas and where we expect connected load to come on. And I won't spend a lot of time other than, of course, the HDL component of that is minimized for a period of time through this moratorium. So this is a look at things kind of with the moratorium on. You can see down in the lower right-hand corner, January 8th, we reported an organic load or a non-HDL load of around 40 megawatts of demand, as well as about 220 megawatts of HDL. And so today, April 2nd, that's recalibrated. We've reached out to a lot of the organic growth applicants and prospects for organic growth. We've recalibrated that number from 40 megawatts down to about 31 megawatts just through improved communications, improved understanding of when those loads will be coming online over the next 3 years or thereabouts. And our HDL mining, we do still have a remaining 2.4 megawatts that is planned, and that was something that was already in process prior to the moratorium. So we'll continue to refresh this view as we move forward, as we learn more. I think right now is that time where we're moving from planning to construction. So each month that we move forward through the year, we're going to have a better projection for you, probably more accuracy. And then again in the fall when the weather comes in, we'll start getting more speculation and planning. So it's a bit of a cycle, and we'll keep you updated on that.
Andy, before you move forward, you go back there for a second. I would like the board just to pause for a second at this, because this is the format that we would intend to use for further quarterly reports. And while there was a great deal of discussion of HDL there, there's quite a bit of organic growth changes that are going on here. For example, I know that there's been some interest in the Mission Ridge expansion. That is smaller now than what was foreseen the last quarterly report, just as they develop their plans and they're looking at what's going to happen in the next couple of years. There isn't as much there. And I would expect this would be something that would be of interest to you, is just thinking through what's going on in the non-HDL areas as well. So, again, just ask you to, don't need feedback today, but you might give this some more thought about, is this working for you in terms of a way of keeping track of what's going on? Because organic growth has a huge impact in terms of our infrastructure investments as well as our FTE needs. So both budget and FTE are dramatically impacted by what happens with organic growth. So want to make sure that you're seeing this as a true leading indicator of where our cost structure is going.
It's a little bit about what we're doing today. Looking forward in the last few slides here, just sort of what we've got in the hopper today and going forward. We're working on doing design work for acquiring some of the capacity out of the South Shore Chelan substation and figuring out a way to bring that down lake down towards town so we can meet some of the growth requests and things on the South Shore. So we're working through the planning phase of constructing what we're calling a third feeder out of the South Shore.
So, Chad, that's the substation on 97A when you drop in.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Chad, let me ask a question, please. On the third feeder, South Shore, is the growth residential, commercial, or a combination?
Combination.
Okay.
I guess I would note too that particular project of the third feeder out of South Shore Chelan, it's a phased project. You may have seen some trucks in the area, some crews in the area doing some preliminary work. Mm-hmm. That work is commencing at this point in time, but there's probably a second and possibly a third phase to that that's still in the planning and design phase going on right now. So.
Just going back to this quickly, if you look at the organic growth in the Chelan area, recreation, commercial, ag, residential developments, that project is in part to support that growth.
Okay.
Also to support that, we're familiar with the property acquisitions for future substations there in North Shore, Chelan, and the Boyd Road area, also in Leavenworth along Chumstick. And we're active moving forward and doing the design work. We're still working through the property issues and permitting for Leavenworth and Chelan, but we're actively performing design work for an additional station in, or substation in Old Station. We're working with the city and understanding this, the expansion plans around McKittrick Street and the North Wenatchee area, understanding that a little bit better, working with them and Stamilt and other groups to understand what load growth is there and siting infrastructure. The Diamond Foundry is included in that, and how the Diamond Foundry is going to be served and what the impacts of that and other organic growth in the area are going to be and what infrastructure we need. We're right in the middle of working through all the details of that. And building into that is the McKittrick Street rebuild. There was a road widening project that supports this. You might have seen work going on McKittrick Street there closer to the avenue. So that work is nearing completion now. It sets kind of the first phase of the things that are going on down there. And then in the discovery and kind of planning phase here is we're working, as Andy mentioned, with Mission Ridge to understand exactly what their long-range plans might be and starting to understand what infrastructure may be required. We're looking at additional lines potentially in substation or substation capacity in the Squilchuck and Upper Squilchuck area. What would that look like? How would that get planned? Funding, all those things. So we have more questions than answers there, but we definitely know that if there's going to be some expansion plans, that we're going to need additional infrastructure. Chelan, the next two here, Slidewater's expansion and Holiday Hills, is in part due to that, in part the needs there for that third circuit out of the South Shore along 97. We're wanting to bring substation capacity down through the lines and things and be able to serve better that South Shore area from kind of the Pat and Mike's area down to the dam, sort of. That substation is meant to serve that area, so additional infrastructure will be required to get the capacity down there.
Chad, what do you show preliminary request for amount of power for Holiday Hills development?
That we're trying to understand that a little bit better, exactly what that number is going to be. We've had applications have come in, and then we've had follow-on discussions, and there's been pauses in some of the applications. So we're really trying to understand exactly what that looks like. But looks like condominiums and some recreational and second home type stuff. So it looks more like residential or condo recreational type loads.
It's looking,
in the hundreds.
It's looking huge.
Yeah.
I know. But I'm not sure of the status of it. So just curious what we've heard on our end.
Yeah, we're trying to pay attention to what the city of Chelan is doing and where they're at in the application process of that. So
yeah. Okay.
I would add that the Holiday Hills development is high on our radar as far
good.
As recognizing it as a significant impact on our infrastructure, significant interest among the city and the residences in that area, and we're trying to be proactive in identifying electrical infrastructure needs and getting ahead of that. I personally have been attempting to reach out to the developers. Haven't had a lot of success, but I'm continuing to do that. And Jenna Rand, our community outreach specialist, is helping me pin them down. So
maybe we should maybe it'd be helpful to reach out, see if we couldn't set up a meeting with Mike Cooney.
And we're in the process of scheduling meetings with them.
Good.
As well.
So. Okay. Good. Thanks.
I would add too that part of our outreach process, in addition to meeting with the municipalities and the county on these load growth issues, we capitalized on the efforts with our key accounts, our large industrial customers, and have asked them in a formal process what do they anticipate for growth and expansion, and we're getting some feedback from them. In Chelan in particular, there's some additional fruit storage that converts into growth. So that's been a very helpful process for us, and we're keeping the channels open with our key accounts and other major developers as well, in addition to the municipalities in the county. So
10-year load forecast. So our load forecast group that Kurt Carlson kind of heads up, cross-departmental subject matter experts, are working on a few things to try to understand what's going on today and how does what's happening today, how do we forecast growth out into the future. They're doing a number of things a little bit differently and trying to look at things from by sector and looking at individual requests rather than looking at sort of a top-down view. So that's been interesting, trying to work through that. And the group's also wanting to put out sort of a formal forecast more frequently, potentially even quarterly, so we can try to understand all that's changing now and how that might impact the long term. What I have here is the load forecast group put out an additional forecast, a 322. And so there was a couple of changes. This is post-moratorium. However, the moratorium is really meant to be something that we take a pause here and understand and give us time to build the processes and rates and work on various other things. So we're trying to understand what really will the impact of that be over the 10 years. So the load forecast group is kind of wrangling and wrangling over that. But the main takeaway here is that the base number has gone up a little bit, gone up about 25 average megawatts due to, in part, the HDL, but also other organic growth, and just a bit bullish on where growth is going to be over the next 10 years. Now, 3% is not a huge number, but it is significant for us and does require a significant amount of infrastructure. The high forecast has come down just slightly as there's a better understanding of some of these longer-term things, including like Mission Ridge, that we're understanding to be a little bit less than what we anticipated, and also the Diamond Foundry. Of course, all these things subject to changes based on new information that we get in.
Yeah, this I think we've shown this map and relative numbers in previous presentations. We wanted to make sure that you had a good understanding of the status of the HDL or the crypto loads as of today. And there again, it's relatively static with the moratorium. There's 22 approved and active HDL loads, totaling an approved amount up to 13.5 megawatts. We're running right around the 9 megawatts as an actual load or an average load right now. And we do anticipate that gap between the 9 and the 13 to be closed. I think I mentioned in a previous slide there was about 2.5 megawatts of HDL that will likely be coming online soon that was previously approved. We think that'll be about the closure, so maybe around 11.5 megawatts. The approved is just, under some of the previous ones where we have the contracts that are allowed to go up to a certain threshold, but some of them just haven't exercised that. And that would be the remaining delta. So, yes.
Good question. Looking at the map, it appears to be a cluster down in the Malaga area. Is there a reason for that?
Commissioner, I heard. Just kidding.
I don't know that there's any reason necessarily for that.
Those dots got moved.
It looks like this.
I think those were meant to be around the Wenatchee area. Yeah. I think the slide might have gotten moved.
That's probably a little bit lower.
That's how Andy does things.
yeah, apologize for that. The slide did get moved. Yeah, I mean, we could move it all over the place if you'd like.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Again, to Steve's point, we're trying to figure out a way to have some common slides as we do these updates so that we can refer back to these. This is one of the ideas that we played with, to just kind of show where these things might be, what's been approved, the magnitude of them. So we hope to recreate this slide with more accurate bullets. Maybe we can pin those to the map rather than letting them slide around.
I think just one last point on this map too. the map is intended to demonstrate again that it's a countywide occurrence, and that it's not limited to just our primary industrial areas. HDL requests and cryptocurrency mining is requested all throughout the county. That thus requires Chad and I to go back to the municipalities and really focus on that zoning and land use planning and say, where do we want to see this HDL loads? Or where do you want to see these HDL loads? So, because if it's distributed, it creates significant more challenges from an electrical infrastructure standpoint than if it's centralized.
So in recap here, we mentioned refining load forecasting projections, load forecast teams working on this, increasing their frequency, and also understanding, as I mentioned, looking at by sector and by request and incorporating that into the forecast. That way, as those modify, change, or drop off, they can recast their forecast with improved accuracy. Capital infrastructure alternatives. We've been, last week we went to Grant PUD and talked to them about that pretty cool thing that they did with the progressive design build and did a number of substations in a very short period of time, pros and cons. They put together kind of list of lessons learned for us, and we had some conversations with them. It was a neat opportunity to understand how well that worked for them. They got a lot of things done in a short period of time. So we're looking into that. And as Andy, and we've been talking about this quite a bit, engaging the growth managers in the county and who are authorized to manage and guide growth are the municipalities and the county. So we want to work very closely with them so that we understand the zones that they're identifying, where those are, and how those zones will impact our needs from a utility standpoint. And, of course, supporting the cryptocurrency moratorium and developing rates, policies, procedures, processes, and various other things.
I just want to say thank you. This is a great report. This is really helpful. Obviously, you guys are really trying to stay ahead of the curve, which is, I know is really, really important. So, yeah, this is great.
I chime in, and I just want to say this was wonderful. I think that being able to put forward a collaborative outreach program, working with the counties and the municipalities, helping to define future locations for growth, and that's also helping the utility as it looks at its cost structure and where it needs to develop. And I have to agree with you. I think having this high-density load demand area, let's just call it an industrial zone, for lack of a better terminology, where we can allocate our resources to accommodate high-density demand, makes a lot of sense rather than allow it to be helter-skelter throughout the county. So I think this is really an exciting time at the district, and the cooperation that we're getting through the municipalities and through the county is fabulous. And I just want to congratulate you guys for spearheading this and putting this outreach program together.
I appreciate that. Working with the municipalities, we're seeing an interest in having discussions not only about where the zoning and land use should take place, but also a recognition that it takes time and a commitment to build the transmission lines, the substations, and the distribution lines. And we think there's some interest in helping site those locations now in a proactive way rather than in a reactive way when it's a little too late. So it's one of our lessons learned from our outreach in Chelan and Leavenworth over the last couple of years. So we're excited what that might bring.
Commissioner McKenna, any comments or thoughts?
Well, I just had one quick question, Andy or Chad. I apologize for not being there and being under the weather, but the planning, the triangle for planning use through zoning, is that specifically a mathematical generated proportional chart? So the demonstration of the the height of each bar is mathematically accurate. And I don't know if that's, so in other words, that cryptocurrency being such a tall and wide bar, does that an accurate mathematical representation over the other areas?
You want to take that? Sure, great question. Yeah, we're trying to illustrate that with this triangle concept here. So mathematically accurate that the consumption by square footage of those facilities is represented by the size, the scale there on the left side of the screen that's going up is mathematically accurate. The actual size of each one of those bars does not scale to it. We are using the triangle as kind of demonstrating that the cryptocurrency, without managing the cryptocurrency correctly and adequately, can consume the resources or crush some of the things that are on the smaller or on the lower side of the scale, which are potentially equally important. So that's what we're trying to illustrate. Yes, the numbers on the left side of the screen, on the left side of the slide there, are accurate in terms of consumption per square footage, which translates to electrical infrastructure.
A powerful image.
It is, yeah.
It could be, yeah, that's a good question, because I wondered about that too. It could be misconstrued. So it's more of a diagrammatic thing to represent. Yeah, so it's not a clear volumetric comparison, band to band.
Correct. Yeah. So we're trying to illustrate here that managing each one of these zones and managing each one of these sectors that are potential growth sectors for utilities and for the entire county, managing of that is very important, because if we don't manage that, one sector could overwhelm the other potentially.
So like the blue sector cryptocurrency, if you look at the volume of that, it would be equivalent, if that represented the exact load usage, it'd be equivalent to half or more of what is represented below it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's fairly accurate, right?
Yeah, when you look at everything from a square footage standpoint, so the way that we'll be working with the municipalities and the county is we'll be looking at actual real estate square footage and understanding the existing and the potential for growth in those areas by square footage. And we understand that a certain sector, let's say the lower end of that triangle for single family or potentially two family or townhouses, is going to have one infrastructure utility requirement. Whereas if that same square footage was going to be used for general industry or cryptocurrency or other type of HDL, a whole different set of utility infrastructure will be required. So the question is, what do we need to plan for that square footage of real estate that the growth managers are desiring?
Yeah. Hard to represent that, but that's good.
Anything else?
Thank you for your time.
No, thank you very much. And I see a little interdepartmental cooperation here between communications and engineering, and it's nice. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good report. Thanks, right, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Item 5.
So next up, we recall that last board meeting we put in place a moratorium, but we knew that would lead to a set of questions associated with, well, if I am or I'm about to be operating a high-density load, what happens in a moratorium? And in particular, what happens if someone continues to operate, which meant that we needed to address the questions associated with what kinds of practices will we have in place that would discourage people from continuing to operate even though the moratorium is in place. And so today we're going to be talking about the alternatives that we put together, and in particular, looking at the costs that are placed on our system and how we would recover those costs. And so So with that, I'll turn it over to John Stoll and team.
Thank you, Steve. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Originally, I hadn't planned to be part of this presentation. It's in the very capable hands of Lindsay and Kathy, but I thought I'd just kick this off. Just kind of setting the stage of why this is pretty critical to put some of these tools in place. I'm just going to go back to last week, where we had, I would say, a bit of an increase, or maybe it's just the progression we're on, where we're discovering unauthorized cryptocurrency mining, generally in the residential area. So just three examples to kind of walk through. One really disturbing, in my opinion, was a very large load being drawn in an apartment unit in Wenatchee here, that you looked at the normal usage of this apartment, it might be 500 kilowatt hours a month, pretty typical for an apartment, where in the transition of 1 month, it went to over 11,000 kilowatt hours. So a 20-fold increase in the amount of power being drawn. You know, in my opinion, that's not really a very safe type of a load to introduce into a small apartment.
John, is that flagged in our software? Or is it something that you just, you know, staff has to go through and just look at every single load?
Yes, we chatted before. Right now, it's latent information, so it's typically after a meter read has occurred. Mm-hmm. So then that goes into the billing system. Sometimes they're discovered on site. It'll flag the meter reader right away, and they'll see something that they'll call, or it may be Carrie and her team looking at it in the office that may uncover there's some high usage. So, but yeah, this one it was probably, I would imagine, in the field. But again, it was really concerning to see that, and really like to commend the team that worked to identify it. And Andy, I know, personally spent quite a bit of time working with the apartment management and this customer as well to cease and desist. And we disconnected immediately and worked through some protocols, what it would take to restore a service there.
John, would you just take a second to highlight the concern moving from an average of 500 kW to 11,000? In terms of infrastructure and what issues that poses?
Well, I would say probably the biggest thing is behind the meter, where it's running through wiring that probably was not designed to pull a constant load and use that amount of power. So then you get into thermal issues and what that could lead to. In my opinion, it's safety and reliability, but a big piece on the safety. Another piece, this was one, we actually had a current cryptocurrency miner who had went through a process, had a storage unit outfitted with a separate meter and paid all the appropriate fees and charges to start mining, but subsequently has kind of worked an arrangement with the manager of that commercial to use other storage units under a different meter that, again, has not gone through an application process, has not been sized appropriately. So again, that's another one very concerning that, you know, it's not designed for that, and here's the load increase. Thirdly, I would say, I know Suzanne Hartman Communications put out the newsletter that went out recently, talked a lot about cryptocurrency and Bitcoin, and we've had a call come in saying, I think, you know, a house that we previously had identified as a remotely operated operation had been activated. So those are just three anecdotal from last week that had risen to the top. Talking to Carrie and others, I think there's probably a large population underneath that maybe are not that egregious, but I think we'll start seeing more of that, and I think it'll be a challenge for staff to put tools in place that's going to communicate and work with them. Some of the things we've talked about is when we think we may have somebody who's doing an HDL, an authorized load, is to do a specific door hanger advising these folks that these are the concerns and to stop immediately. Some of the tools you'll hear with Kathy and Lindsay, we'll kind of talk about that as well. But again, we just, you know, personally, my gut tells me I think we're going to start seeing more of this. We've had a pretty mild winter when you look back to last winter, which was a lot colder. So some of those high bills, they look at previous usage in a similar time frame. If you had a very cold winter, plus a mild winter and more usage, it may mask some of those flags that you would see. As we've talked before, ideally in the future with a automated metering system, we would see some of that information near real time and be able to flag that instead of waiting for the reads. But we're a ways off from that.
So, John, can you just ballpark tell us, say, last week or in a month's time, how much additional staff time is being is required to deal with all this unauthorized use?
I think that's probably a good opportunity to turn it over to Kathy, because I think she has that information, which you'll see. But it just cut to the chase. It takes an awful lot of staff time to work through these.
Before we go there, I want to put an even stronger point on that first example that John used. I think it's deeply troubling that someone was going from 500 kilowatt hours to 11,000 kilowatt hours in an apartment. Putting their neighbors at risk. So John used the word thermal. I want to make it stronger than that. It was a fire risk that was created. And so we are talking about a severe human health and safety issue that was uncovered here. And this has got to stop. We have to find a way to address this.
Yeah, just to make a comment, in a previous life, associated with the Chelan County Fire Department, we used to find wintertime when there was a consistent load and the wiring was less than adequate, for the load, and the load was continuing, the thermal condition as described ends up with a charring effect on wood frame, even though it's insulated wire, etc. And that charring over time lowers the kindling temperature. So what would be normal in terms of a fire expectation and resistance to that fire is lessened to the point where you enhance the possibility of an internal fire in the wall versus just normal use. And so it's an issue that ultimately then results in a wall fire that spreads and then erupts in more than one place. And although construction is established to prohibit that, it still transfers and happens because it follows the wiring, in this case, from one unit to the other. And so it's an entirely disturbing disregard for anyone else's safety who lives in that environment. And just has, there's no, should be no toleration whatsoever for that level of non-consideration for human life and safety. So I'm thinking if I had an apartment and children next door. Anyway, so I'm being mild, but insistent that this has to end.
The other complication, I don't know if John mentioned, but I just confirmed with Andy, it was a remote operated operation, so there wasn't even any person present there, so any fire probably wouldn't have been detected until it was impacting another apartment or people within the building.
Definitely.
And I would thank you, Commissioner, appreciate your perspective on that, and would like to acknowledge that immediate actions were taken, including not only what Andy did, but, I informed Eric, who informed the city attorney, just to let a broader audience know that this is going on.
Well, and I think regarding the storage unit, I think another thing that people need to be aware of is that this wasn't innocent. The payment, as I understand it, for the additional usage was under the table, avoiding common means of payment and awareness on our part of what was being demanded and by what person, etc. If not illegal, certainly unethical. That's why Steve's not here today.
Thank him for that.
Yes, that's right.
We have. Yes, wonderful.
I'd just like to chime in here because it seems to me as we begin trying to connect dots, or as I try to connect dots in my head,
I want to take one step back, and I want to say that users of power that have legitimate requests and have been properly sized for the use of that power, that's not the kind of entity we're discussing today. What we're discussing is a person who is purposely trying to slip around the end and use power in a way that the facility was not designed for, and doing so in a manner where there's been no request for service to meet that kind of demand. It harkens in my mind a need for a way other than waiting for the meter reader to come around at the end of the month to read the meter, to have feedback so that if we're encountering scoundrels who wish to get past the regulatory and the normal procedures to request size and demand, that the automated metering would be one of those instruments that would help us to discover those folks who are doing so illegally. And so as we've had these discussions about automated metering in the past, I see yet once again a reason to support the installation of an automatic meter to be able to confront these scoundrels before they do burn an apartment building down and perhaps kill a family or children in this process. So anyway, I just wanted to have my two cents that I once again see dots getting connected here.
Thank you, John.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Kathy Melton, for those of you that it's been a while since I've been up here. And thank you, John, for walking into that and bringing all those discussion points up. So today our presentation will be following up on some of the enforcement tools that we are providing a preview of today that will aid staff in the administration of those unauthorized uses that we're finding out in the field. No action is being requested of you today. This is a preview. We will be circling back with you at an upcoming board meeting with the red lines of the regulation changes and, of course, supporting fees and charges changes as well to give you an idea of what that would look like. So our existing regulations now, we made changes to these actually last year that require all HDL customers to obtain approval from the district prior to starting or certainly from expanding their existing services. And that approval is gained through the application process. The application process is really key to all of this. It allows our engineering staff an opportunity to review the infrastructure that's in place and, of course, ties back to that safety element of it. We need an opportunity to make sure that the infrastructure is properly sized to accommodate this entirely different nature of load. So what we would be recommending moving forward with is actually creating a definition of the unauthorized use in our regulations, and that would be for any use in our service territory that did not follow the application process. And then, of course, highlighting within our regulations the consequences of not following that approval process and for being found subject to unauthorized use. So the proposed fees that I will be sharing with you today include the investigation and the monitoring, and those would be the cost recovery mechanisms put into place to capture all of the costs associated with the work that Carrie and others that are putting forth right now while we are investigating these unauthorized uses. That includes several different tasks, including phone calls, letters, bill evaluations, specialty metering being installed, data analytics. So in total, the proposed fees that we're looking at for that, for the investigation and monitoring, would be at that $3,400 mark. So those fees would be assessed to those that are found to have engaged within unauthorized use. And then this slide just gives you a snapshot of the folks on our teams that are involved in this. This is definitely not an exhaustive list of everything that goes into dealing with the unauthorized use that we're finding out there, particularly since more often than not, these unauthorized uses are found in the residential areas. We have to be very swift. And we have to stay focused on what's going on with that. also, along with that, once we have had contact with the customer and asked them to cease operations, we have to continue monitoring that. We have on more than one occasions found that we'll get temporary compliance from that individual, and not only for them just to turn back around and ramp back up a week or two later. So we do have to continue monitoring that to make sure that there is not a safety situation that continues.
So in addition to the customer service and metering fees that we have for investigating and looking at the various unauthorized loads, we do also have equipment infrastructure challenges, or degradation, as we call it. We talked about this a little bit at our last meeting, where when we evaluate an HDL service, we're having to upsize equipment, transformers, wires on our side of the meter to ensure that our system is safe as well. John talked a bit, you know, with the apartment building, that's within their facilities, but our facilities also have to be considered. So when these services are not reviewed or authorized, we do see that equipment running hotter and the life decreasing in it. So while we may have expected 30 years of life out of a piece of equipment, we either can see it fail in real time with the HDL usage on it, or when a potential new customer comes into that house or apartment or wherever they've been operating, then the equipment fails sooner than we would have expected. So our maintenance and whatnot's not planned for that. It's planned for the full life. So we're proposing, in addition to the fees Kathy discussed, is an equipment degradation fee. In order to recoup that full cost of our investment from the customer who's creating the cost. So of course, if equipment failed while the customer was there, we would charge them the full cost for repair and replacement of that. This is for equipment that has not yet failed, but that we expect to in the future. And right now, we're still working through these numbers, making sure that we've basically identified all of the different costs that would be involved. But we're pretty comfortable with these right now. A typical residential equipment degradation fee, a single transformer and wire, at around the $1,500 range to replace those. And those are based on what we charge for new installations. So we do charge for this already when a new customer comes in. So this would just be those same ballpark costs. And then on the commercial side of things, are more expensive. Of course, they're usually three-phase. And so either if it's an overhead installation, have three transformers, or if it's an underground, have a larger single transformer. Do notice that there's one abbreviation there that we didn't define. UG is underground and OH is overhead. So those are the two different types of service for those commercial. So in the $6,800, $6,900 range and $4,000 for the overhead. So as Kathy mentioned, our next steps are to bring back our red lines of the regulations, and those have to be approved by the board via resolution. So any changes that we make there will be back in a resolution form. And also provide you the final numbers for the fees and charges. We'll talk about strategies at our next presentation for you. An amnesty period, or a self-reporting period, where people who are operating and may truly not have understood that they needed approval have that opportunity to let us know what they're doing and committing to stop until the moratorium is over and they've followed the appropriate process and been approved and had their equipment sized properly. So for a period of time, we'd allow that in the early stages. And we'd also talk about some implementation and escalation strategies. So do we charge all of the fees all at once? Do we start with a portion of the investigation fee and then later follow on with the equipment degradation if we see the activity continuing? So we'll talk some about those strategies and staff's recommendation there that's developing. And then we'll also bring forward our communication plan for informing all of our customers of the change, because there are, I'm sure, those people out there who maybe don't read their connections newsletter, but reaching out and letting them know these are coming. So with that, if you have any questions, we'd be happy to take those.
Commissioners? A short story in terms of avoiding the meters in a neighboring county. police officer stopped for lunch at a fast food place. When he got back into his patrol car, looked at the side of the apartments in front of him and realized there were three apartments connected by bright orange cords. And it was to attempt to spread the usage across 3 meters instead of one. And he didn't have a strong background in electricity, but thought that was pretty unusual and had the county come out and take a look at it. And it was a mine operating in the middle with other apartments feeding in to spread the load on the meters. So fairly clever idea. Bright orange cords on a slightly green building was pretty obvious. So, you know, some clever thinking and not so clever, but that's how thieves generally get caught. So thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you.
That. Steve, I'm sorry. Any questions or comments?
No, I think my only two takeaways from this is the obvious reinforcement of what Steve said on the safety issues. But, you know, there's also, you know, the individuals that are doing this inappropriately and illegally are also having an impact on the people that are trying to do it correctly. And that unintended consequence for impacting people that are even in their own field, you know, they're hurting each other and their business opportunities. So, you know, that kind of hit me today as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Good point, Steve. Thank you. Thank you, ladies, very much.
Thank you.
At this point, I'd like to invite Nick Martini, who requested the opportunity to address the commission. And Nick, I would invite you to come forward, use the handhold microphone, because our meetings are recorded, and the public has access to those presentations that way. And if you could state your name and your residential address.
Sure.
And you've got approximately 5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Nick Martini. I come from Half Moon Bay, California. And so after we got done talking about all the villains and scoundrels, probably not the best timing to be making my pitch to the tough crowd. So I'm thinking about trying to establish, you know, a legitimate, properly approved operation here, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about the moratorium and the effect that it has on my plans. And really what my request is for the board to consider a more flexible approach to the moratorium. I think that, you know, looking at the publications, if you look at it in the aggregate, you know, there are a lot of applications asking for a lot of energy. But if you look at the individual applications, what you might see is, you know, my application is for about 100 kilowatts, which is admittedly a lot of energy, but probably not as much as a lot of the other applications that are asking for 1 megawatt or more. I think if you look at all of these applications, what you'll see is a lot of people coming in asking for, you know, a ton of energy. My application, I think, has been swept in with all of those. And so what I'm hoping is that the board might consider, you know, instead of the aggregate, looking at the individuals and seeing what they've done and how they're approaching it. So my approach to this, even before I filed the application, I came to Chelan PUD and asked, you know, hey, this is what I'm thinking about doing. And I came in and asked for 300 kilowatts to start with. And so before I filed the application, I talked to Tammy Fisher and Daniel Scott and learned about all of the problems that are going on. And that conversation led me to say, okay, there's a lot of demand and they're having trouble dealing with it. The responsible thing is to dial it back. And so for my application, what I requested was 100 kilowatts, doing a smaller amount. And the reason for this is because the mine that I want to create is not the be-all, end-all for me. This is more an experiment so that I can learn about this growing industry, identify the inefficiencies, and potentially create some businesses and jobs out of that. And I think that there are a lot of inefficiencies in this business right now. And so in order to do that, I need to set up a small mine. It doesn't need to be, you know, 10 megawatts. I need a bunch of machines to see, okay, here are the problems that people are dealing with. Here's a potential business where I could have employees come out and service machines or create parts that would help with those machines. But this moratorium has really put me in a bad spot, because in order to file the HDL application, you need a property, and you need some sort of property owner. And coming from Half Moon Bay, California, not surprisingly, I don't have property here. So looking at, you know, the process, I put a bid in on a property and thinking, okay, a month and a half from bid till closing, that should be enough time to get an answer from Chelan PUD after talking with Chelan PUD employees and getting a rough idea of how long it would take. By the time I close, I should have a good idea. Will this property work? How much will it cost? Can I get the energy that I need? And so I filed the application, paid the fee, 2 weeks of review, and then all of a sudden the moratorium comes in. And, you know, we're not looking at your application anymore. Now it's going to close before I can possibly get an answer. And I have to make a decision. Do I want to put six figures into a project where I don't know if it's going to work at all? Or do I want to let this go and clearly someone will swoop in and get that property? Since I put that bid in on this property, three different people have inquired about buying it. So it kind of puts me in a difficult situation in terms of, I'd like to do this. I'd like to go into this experiment and I think do something that will actually be beneficial for Wenatchee, but I'm in a situation where I can't really win. And so what I'm asking is for the board to consider a more flexible approach. And, you know, my application, while it's asking for a lot of energy, isn't, you know, the guy who's asking for 5 megawatts. And actually, just listening to this conversation, I have some ideas about how to deal with these problems that you were just talking about, these rogue cryptocurrency miners, how to make sure that people don't do that. But I only have 5 minutes, so I will let you ask questions. And if you want to approach me about it, I'll be around the rest of the day, you know, during a break. I'm happy to talk about any aspect of this.
Nick, thank you. I appreciate it. And you're also timely. So thank you very much. And yeah, we'll probably reserve questions for right now to wrap up our morning's schedule. Appreciate it and appreciate the civil tone.
Just a comment. you know, Nick, it might be helpful. It sounds to me like it might be helpful for you to visit with Andy or John, to visit with our staff. And, you know, they probably would learn something from you in terms of, because you're on the other side of this, in terms of how to deal with these difficult
I'm happy to talk.
Operators.
I'm happy to talk to anyone, anytime.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, my view is, and from the start of this process, was I'm not on the other side. I'm not an opponent. I want to work with you to make this a valuable part of the community. And so nothing about what I've done from the very start, you know, it's above the table, making sure that everything is, all the I's are dotted, all the T's are crossed. As I said, I'm an attorney. I know what happens when you don't do that. And so I view this as a partnership. And that's why I'm here, why I drove up from Half Moon Bay to meet you, because I'm going to be seeing you people in the future, and I want to have a good relationship and make sure you know who I am when I contact you.
Yeah, so I would suggest that part is what you would really need to develop in terms of how you can be a partner and what your business would contribute to the community. You know, if you could really flesh all that out for us and help us understand, you know, exactly how you will contribute jobs. You said develop businesses, community involvement. You know.
I already have a lot of ideas, specific ideas, that I'm happy to, as I said, my time's probably up, but I could list them out now if you wanted to hear that. But, you know, I'll be around all day if you want to talk about it, or anyone. You know, I'm happy to describe what I'm thinking.
Thanks for coming
in. Perfect. Thank you.
So, commissioners, if I might, and for Mr. Martini's benefit, I think we have the public hearing scheduled for May 14th, I want to say, on this. And we'll make sure that your comments are included as part of that. You're also welcome to attend on the 14th, but that would be the first opportunity for the board to revise the moratorium, as you suggest, or otherwise.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, we're going to move to item 8 and then come back to 7 if we have time this morning, and then 6 this afternoon on the agenda. So, Steve Wright, please.
So we're revisiting an issue that we talked about at the end of the first quarter financial review. Recall that we had a very good year last year, and that we are considering whether to take a portion of that good year and put it into the strategic facilities plan. Kelly Boyd has a presentation that will remind you of what that issue is. And then this is really for board action, your determination as to whether this is the right path to be going down. Kelly?
So thank you, Steve. Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
So for the record, I am Kelly Boyd, Chief Financial Officer, and this is an action item following up from our year-end financial review. Just to give the quick background on the board-designated fund for the long-term strategic facilities plan, it was a fund established by the board in April of last year. It was for the purpose of investing in the long-term strategic facilities plan. It was established to demonstrate that the board is planning ahead for that identified need. And it is a fund that remains unrestricted for external reporting purposes because the board has the ability to increase or decrease the amount in it, or establish or unestablish it. And then after the fund was established, an initial deposit was made of $20 million into the fund in July of last year. So with that quick background, options for this year to deposit an additional amount into the fund include a couple options that we've put together. Option one is another $20 million deposit into the fund, which represents the amount that 2017 results exceeded budget. And it's just a coincidence that both years that amount was $20 million. So I'm not sure that we can create that result again this year of exceeding budget on our bottom line. So I don't want to create that expectation from the CFO standpoint. but that is the amount that was exceeded. This is staff's initial preference, I guess, on options, because as we forecast the future in our financial model, all of the funds are kind of fully dedicated to the expected plans. So when we exceed those expected plans, that amount going into a designated fund has a nice symmetry to it. Although option two is this is a board designated and board directed fund. So any amount that's the preference of the board is appropriate for this fund. And because the board can direct an increase or a decrease in the fund, and they can also direct any specific projects for the funds to be applied to related to the long-term strategic facilities plan, there's really a lot of flexibility here. So with that, I'll defer to the board for discussion.
And I'll open up with asking Commissioner Arsenault if he has any comments or thoughts.
I do, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make a motion. First of all, I want to step back and say that I think that this having designated funds set aside for facilities planning, when we know that the cost will be a large dollar amount, demonstrates a stewardship on the part of both the commission but also staff to look into the future, which we have seen today from our customer surveys, is one of the things important to our customer owners, is that we take a long-term vision. 30 years was the number discussed this morning. And clearly, as we look at our current facility, and we have discussed this many times, it's an aging structure. And with that, maintenance cost continues to escalate. So it's only prudent that I think the board take action to demonstrate to our customer owners the fact that we take spending money very seriously. And so given that, and looking towards the future, I'd like to make a motion.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to direct staff to deposit an amount of $30 million into the board designated fund that was established last April 3rd, 2017, for the purpose of investing in the long-range strategic facilities plan and renaming that fund the headquarters slash service center strategic facilities fund to make it clear that the funds were designated for the use for headquarters and the service center solutions.
Is there a second to the motion?
I'll second the motion. This is Steve McKenna.
Okay. It has been moved and seconded. There's a motion on the table. And let's please open it up for discussion.
Commissioner
Congdon.
So I talked with Commissioner Arsenault, and I had said that that I would support $30 million recommendation. But if that's what all the other commissioners want to do, I'll go along with it. But I did tell him, and I still feel like I support. I'd rather see it be a $20 million number, because that is just about what our surplus is, and also that is the staff recommendation. And I feel like the staff knows a lot more about these things than I do. You know all the numbers in the background on it. So my preference would be $20 million. The way you've renamed it, that's fine with me. I support that. Steve, I'd like to ask you your thoughts on this.
I think, first of all, the concept behind having a facilities reserve fund is a good one. It speaks to the commitment to addressing what produces the most value for people over the long run for our customer owners. So very much appreciate and support the board's direction to establish the reserve fund. As to the actual amount, it has been our recommendation to use the amount that we were over last year and the year before. But because the board retains the discretion to be able to alter the use of the fund through time, we are entirely comfortable with an alternative number, including the $30 million number. So I wouldn't want our staff recommendation to be viewed as, that clearly is the right number and there is no other right number from our perspective. We're quite comfortable with the $30 million approach, and it does put in place a more substantial number. We know we're looking at potentially for the headquarters and service center, we've estimated that cost at about $115 million. Important to separate those, roughly $75 million for the service center. The fleet and other activities are the more expensive part of the cost here, and about $30 million for the headquarters. So having $50 million as opposed to $40 million put into the reserve would be a good-sized down payment towards the ultimate cost that we're looking at. So, again, I would say we are comfortable with the motion, as we were comfortable with the original staff recommendation, and don't see a significant difference or challenge between the two.
Mr. McKenna, any thoughts?
I appreciate Ann's comments and thinking on that. But in my mind, what this is doing is it's pushing us a little bit harder than the comfort of here's the excess in this last year's budget. And I think this will... I think we really owe it to ourselves to push hard on this. I've just had enough experience asking for support for administration facilities and service facilities And that's not always the most popular thing to do, but it's necessary. And by us pushing ourselves to really work hard to set this money aside and not impact our ratepayers, I think is just wise thinking on my part. And if we can do this and not disrupt the organization, and Steve's comfortable with this, with the idea that if need be, we can change our mind later on when we see, if and when we see that we, you know, we push too hard, then we can change that and fall back to a $20 million later on. There's nothing that precludes us from doing that. But I just like the idea that we're dedicated to this and we're pushing hard on it. And that's where my comfort level is.
I guess my problem is once we designate $30 million, I don't know how we pull back on that. I mean, I think once that $30 million is designated, it's done. I think it would be difficult to go back. Sorry, Gary. We talked about this, and I don't want to go against what I told you. I would support generally what the rest of the commissioners want to do. The other concern I have is the renaming of it or designating it specifically to a new headquarters. I would feel more comfortable if it were designated more generally for the whole strategic facility.
So, Commissioner, I want to be clear. The motion and the renaming is not for specifically a new headquarters as written. It's for service center and headquarters solutions. That could be a new headquarter, but it could be also something different. So I intentionally left that the way it is. Just to address that specific perspective, that it is for a particular, you know, one building in one spot. We don't have a spot yet. So I wanted to make it clear that the solutions could be, frankly, less anything the board directs.
Less specifically
yes.
designated, yeah.
Yeah, and then the only other comment I wanted to make clear is that your earlier comment about harder to back away from or change, I just want to echo Kelly's point that it's a board-designated fund, so there wouldn't be any restriction on the board in changing the use of that money or pulling money back or reducing the size or redirecting the use of that fund at any time simply by motion. So when you say more difficult to back away, I'm assuming you don't mean, and that's what I'm trying to be clear about, the fact that this isn't as though we are somehow now tied to this purpose legally. The board can choose to respond.
No, I do. Thank you. I do understand. It's not illegal.
I knew you did. I just wanted to make sure that your comment on the record was that it wouldn't be legal.
Yeah. I'm just looking ahead at the forward prices and costs going up and revenue going down and potentially rate increases, small incremental rate increases in the near future. So I'm just mindful of all of that. I'll need to stick to what I said. If everybody else goes along with it, I will too. As long as I know there's, you know, definite amount of flexibility built into it where changes can be made just as soon as they need to be.
I just want to say we can provide that assurance that you have that flexibility.
Yeah, I wasn't agreeing or disagreeing with your comments, Commissioner. I was just merely trying to clarify that I think you do have that flexibility.
Okay.
Kelly, I have two brief but related questions. The additional $10 million, what would be its source? And secondly, regardless of the source, what impact would that have on our five-year financial plan?
So the source would be our existing funds out of our general fund into this specific designated fund. And it doesn't change the overall plan because these are still in the overall funds that we would have available. It's just specifically setting aside some of those funds for these specific projects. Yes. And those projects are generally in the forecast, so there is a matching of that.
I think Kelly helped me with this. Well, the board in the fall did alter the financial forecast to take into account our updated estimates for facilities costs. And so embedded in that, at least, are the operational costs associated with maintaining the existing buildings. And so what would end up happening is if we go forward with a purchase of land or the building of new facilities, there'd be some capital cost changes that would be relatively modest in terms of the impact on the overall financial forecast. Did I say that in a way that you were comfortable with?
If I can just repeat to understand, we do have a reflection of this long-term strategic plan in our forecast. I think that's confirming what you said. So we will refine it as we know more as we go along, but that's where these funds, again, they don't change our overall funds available, but they do specifically set aside some for the project, and we do have that overall project reflected in our long-term financial forecasts.
And I guess where my comfort is, by taking the vote today, should the motion pass, does not bind this commission or a future commission from making a change. Should we see our finances as a little bit different, we can certainly restructure that and respond appropriately at the time, should we need to.
That is definitely a benefit of this type of fund, is that it is completely board-directed. There are not external requirements. It is at the direction of the board.
Yes, please.
One more clarification. So, Eric, the naming, the renaming of this, so I still feel a little bit bound in by this being a fund designated for headquarters slash service center options. So say we wanted to do something at Rocky Reach, something related to museum, exhibit, something else, this fund could not be used for that.
So
unless we change the motion, the naming.
So just like the proposed motion does today, it would, I'm going to say, hone in on the intent, and all it is an expression of the board's intent of these funds currently. Staff would not use these funds for projects, as you've described, at Rocky Reach, without coming back to the board and saying, we have a need. Here is a source of funds, and seeking the board approval for the either redesignation of the fund in total, like it's being proposed today, or just removing some funds from it to dedicate to another facilities. It's to other facilities. Really more of direction, a public expression of the board's intent, and it does provide guidance for staff in terms of we would not dip into this fund for those purposes without board authorization, but it does not at all limit in any way. I just want to be perfectly clear. The board giving that direction, changing the name again next year, rededicating funds to other purposes, that is completely at your discretion.
So I think, yeah, but staff, would you do that? That's the hard question. Would you be willing to come to the commissioners and say, you know what, we have a need over here. I know you designated it generally for this, but we have a need. I mean, would you do that?
Certainly.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
I would feel comfortable with that.
I was say, yeah, that's a Steve question, and he's saying to be comfortable. So, and I guess I would be completely chagrined if the staff, including senior management, was not willing to do that. That would show the dysfunction between board and staff that I would be totally uncomfortable with. So I would expect you to enlighten us should that need occur.
So, Commissioner, just to be clear, I think those are the kinds of things that we do all the time as staff when you carry your approved resolutions. In fact, one of them was moved consent today, for example, was seeking to add additional dollars. So the board has taken action by delegating authorities in a sort of a blanket fashion, telling staff you can do things within these parameters without having to come back to us. But the alternative is, in many of your resolutions, you will award a project and those resolutions will carry a not to exceed or a without further board approval type of direction. And it's very common for staff to come back and seek to add. One of the things that we always look at as staff is
whether or not that step is necessary, because is it a delegated authority or is it something that you've told us in the resolution? I don't see this as any different than that.
I hope not, because you have a better sense of the overall financial picture and the and how the pieces of the puzzle have to be moved around to make it all work. So, absolutely. Just because the board said we want this for this, we need to know that you are willing to come back and say we'd like you to consider this. All right. Thanks
for asking the question.
Yes. And then in talking with Commissioner Arsenault, if I look at the last sentence, it says to make it clear that the funds are designated for headquarters/service center. And I asked Commissioner Arsenault if he would be comfortable with the word designated being struck and the word designed be included, so that would be, it would read, to make it clear that the funds are designed for use of headquarter and service center solutions.
Yeah, that's a little better.
Is that, so do we need to amend the motion?
Commissioner Arsenault can...
Or maybe he misspoke the first time.
I'm sure it was my typo, actually. It was probably intended to be designed.
I definitely accept.
But I think you could accept
change
the amendment.
The motion, the amendment change.
And move forward.
Okay. So we have a motion. Is there any further discussion? So we have a motion on the floor to direct staff to deposit $30 million into the board designated fund that was established last April 3rd, 2017, for the purpose of investing in long-term strategic facilities plan and renaming the fund the headquarters/service center facilities fund to make it clear that the funds are designed for use for headquarters/service center solutions. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion is carried.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Kelly.
And I did say $30 million, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Thank you.
I was just trying to figure if I could get a five-minute item in. And I'm not...
Oh, Mark is here. I was looking for you. Sorry, I didn't turn around far enough.
Yeah. Would it be okay if we did a manager's item?
Oh, yeah.
Fill in the remaining 5 minutes. So we have, we're bringing back, we had a request for some information on a subject, and it's taken us a while to gather that information, but Mark is here to present it to you. So, again, this is in response to a question from the board at a previous meeting.
So this is fall under 16, a portion of 16?
Yes.
Okay.
Good morning. Mark Mullins, Director, Enterprise Risk Management, and as Steve mentioned, this is in response to a question that Commissioner Smith had with respect to our lost revenue recovery for our insurance policies. As you recall, Kelly presented the 2017 financial results, and she identified that the district received $3.9 million in insurance recovery as a partial payment for the large unit repairs, and included in that was a $3 million lost revenue component. Commissioner Smith asked if the district was kept whole for that recovery, and Kelly responded that it is subject to deductibles, which is absolutely correct, but I wanted to provide a little bit more information on those policies that we have in place with respect to those units. So back when C-10 was taken out of service, the district had business interruption insurance associated with our mechanical breakdown policy. And at that time, it was a zero-day deductible. So it's a little different than a dollar deductible, but a zero-day, meaning that when the mechanical breakdown event occurs, that we're eligible for recovery for lost revenue protection. Subsequently, future renewals of that same policy resulted in a 60-day renewal, or a 60-day waiting period. So those other units, C8, C9, and C11, are subject to a 60-day waiting period, meaning that when the mechanical breakdown occurs, that we have to wait 60 days before we would be eligible to recover from lost revenue perspective. So I also wanted, in addition to that, I also wanted to add that the district was responsible for developing the model that calculates what that lost revenue is. And the model effectively looks at a baseline of four healthy operating large units and compares that to what would be the impact if we lost one of those units. So the district worked with our insurance provider for these large claims, Hartford Steam Boiler, and they agreed with our methodology and to utilize that approach to determine what our lost revenue recovery is. So that's where we're at today. To date, we've received $3.6 million in lost revenue recovery from insurance proceeds. This is for C10 and C8 only. We still have two other units that we've filed notice for, but we're waiting for the results of disassembly of those units for the longer-term repair options. And at that time, future information will be known on the recovery from a lost revenue perspective associated with those units. Are there any other? That's what I had today. I can go on, but I wanted to get a better sense if that was responsive to Commissioner Smith's question.
Question I have, Mark, on the 60-day now. So we have to we notify the insurance company that we have an outage. We wait 60 days before it kicks in.
Well, the 60 days, we'd have to wait 60 days before we're eligible, meaning the calculation
right.
would start 60 days after the mechanical breakdown event occurred.
So it was there a reduction in the premium, or did the premium stay the same for a 60-day wait?
Well, it's not quite as transparent to know exactly. It was through the insurance policy renewal process that Ron Gibbs handles. So he's negotiating all of those things in aggregate, so it could have been a component.
Okay.
It wasn't specifically asked for or negotiated, but that was the result.
So that piece has not been broken out. It's part of an aggregate discussion and agreement on
Correct.
The price of the policy
Correct.
For the duration.
Yep. It's actually okay. a component of our property insurance policy.
Yeah. So we don't know.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks.
I think we're prepared to call it a morning.
Okay. So we will adjourn, recess for lunch and return at 1 o'clock. All right.
He doesn't have a mute.
On he doesn't have a mute on his right. phone. Okay. I did hear a sneeze at one point. I thought that was really validated his reason for not being here today. Good afternoon. It's 4 minutes after 1. We're coming back into session after our lunch recess, Chelan County Board of Directors, April 2nd. And we've got a couple of changes. Item 7 on our agenda, the climate change impact. I think we're going to do that next meeting. And then we've moved item number 6, the Chelan Boat Club Agreement. To the afternoon agenda, and so we're now at the consent agenda. Commissioners, the consent agenda has been amended to include, and I'm trying to see where I put it in my notes, 12 and 15. Resolutions 12 and 15. So what is your desire at this point?
So I'll move approval of the consent agenda as modified.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to accept the consent agenda as presented with modifications to resolutions 12 and 15 to be included. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the consent agenda, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. So that moves us to 11.
Actually, if we could, we're going to take the morning item that we skipped over.
Okay.
The Lake Chelan Boating Club Agreement.
Perfect.
And invite Jeff Smith to come up. We have a visitor as well.
Thank you.
So when you hear him, his voice, you'll all know who he is.
Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Jeff Smith, Managing Director of District Services. And I'd like to introduce you to Steve Byquist, the longtime name and voice behind the microphone at KOZI Radio for many, many years in Chelan. Glad to have him here.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Now the Commodore of the Lake Chelan Boating Club. So we recently finalized an agreement between the PUD and the Boating Club for Old Mill Park. Included a required nod of approval from FERC. FERC actually sent us notice they were approving it about 10 days ago. Before we review some of the key provisions of the agreement, Steve, why don't you use that graphic over here to your left and just outline the park in relationship to the portion that's occupied by the Boating Club.
This would be Old Mill Park, starting at your breakwater out to Highway, the Chelan Manson Roadway, going across Project Mountain. So this direction, Lakeland Boat Club occupies this space here on your lower right, and these are our docks into the lake.
So this matter dates back to 1983. PUD permitted the Boating Club to temporarily occupy an undeveloped portion of Old Mill Park, on which the club subsequently developed a clubhouse, two docks, and a lawn area. The short-term agreement became longer-term with sublease renewals every 5 years. The new agreement provides the club with certainty of its long-term future at the site. Among the key provisions of the agreement, the club will raise public awareness and improve public access to the lawn area by removing a permanent fence. The club will pay the PUD a yearly fee of $4,800 with an annual CPI adjustment for lease of the grounds and dock permits. And the term of the agreement is consistent with the current hydro project license, which expires in November 2056. At this point, turn it over to Steve for some comments about the improvements and the agreement.
Real quick history lesson, if we could. The Lake Chelan Boat Club was formed in 1954. Mission is to improve and better boating on Lake Chelan, and have done numbers of projects up and down the lake over the years. The first major project, one of the first major projects, occurred, and you have a black and white photo, aerial photo, I believe, in Manson Bay. The club was formed in 54, and there was no launch ramps on the north shore of Lake Chelan at that time, and you can't hardly be boating on the lake without launch ramps. So the club decided that they would go through a fundraising and build a public boat ramp and launch facility in Manson Bay. This would be the dock on the lower left of your black and white photo, old photo dated 1972. And that was the only launch ramp on the north shore of Lake Chelan for a good period of time. We borrowed money, we raised funds, put in a 120-foot long pier, and improved the boat ramp right across the road from the Manson Fire Station, if you're familiar with the downtown Manson area. It wasn't too terribly long after that that it became overwhelmed with people, the public, using the facility, part of our mission to improve boating on Lake Chelan. And so we had the opportunity to buy a couple, three lots of property, and that would be the upper dock that you see there. And we bought a couple lots in there and began improvement, putting in docks and the like. And it became, in fact, quite a moorage spot for boat club members. It was a semi-public facility when the other one, the public ramp, was overused. We'd open up the club facility for launching. Over time, as you got into the Exhibit R of the 1980-era relicensing of the Lake Chelan Hydro Project, it was determined that the Exhibit R portion, the recreation portion of that particular renewal, the community would like to see some improvements there in Manson Bay. After a lot of deliberation and the like, the utility commenced on that Exhibit R and approached us on selling the property. We weren't particularly willing sellers at that point, and so we had some significant discussions as to what might happen to the club and our ability to use the waterfront. We became willing sellers when the utility gave us the option of occupying the space that I pointed out on the large map just a moment ago. As the utility continued its Exhibit R, and now I'll refer to the next colored photo that you have, you developed the Old Mill launch ramp, and the picture that you see as your phase one done And next to it, as you go in a downlake direction or from left to right, you'll see the remnants of the old mill and a couple of white trailers sitting on some property. Those are actually double-wide trailers that I went to Tri-Cities of Washington Public Power Supply System and bought them surplus, and they became our clubhouse. The clubhouse that's there now, which looks nothing like a double-wide trailer, I assure you. That lawn area immediately downlake or to the right is the area that we're talking about where the club grounds are located now. As Ann would remember, a good portion of this property was sawdust left over from the mill. There was a lot of, I see some nods back there, there was a lot of excavation needed to be done to remove the old remnants from the mill, and including the Lakeshland Boat Club property. So a good part of the money that we garnered from the public utility in selling those lots in Manson Bay went to actually moving sawdust and debris and the like away and bringing in topsoil, compacting and whatnot so we could get on with our project. That's a brief history of the club and how we came to enjoy the property that we're on and have been since, and look forward to years of continuing to occupy that space. The club itself, the facility there, is used on nearly a daily basis. We have weekly Bible studies, occasional AA groups. The sheriff's office trains people there. As Steve McKenna would remember, the Manson school kids come down at end of school and have their end of school parties, grade school kids. We have educational opportunities for Manson primarily, students to come down and learn safety around the water. We've had funerals, funeral receptions, weddings, wedding receptions, class reunions, dozens of class reunions, on and on. And in fact, most summers, the facility is only used by the boat club exclusively on one, maybe two weekends. So it's a, as Ann would realize as well, it's a well-used facility, and the community has the opportunity to enjoy the fact that it exists. Simultaneous with that, the club involves itself in numbers of improvement projects, primarily on Forest Service grounds and campgrounds in Upper Lake Chelan. Building and helping maintain docks, building stairways, improving pathways, those kinds of things. In addition to the club property that we have at Lucerne, we spend a lot of time up lake doing maintenance on some of your, in fact, PUD partially funded amenities that are in Upper Lake Chelan. So a bit about the boat club.
So the district has another agreement with Manson Parks and Recreation District to operate and maintain Manson Bay and Old Mill Parks. To provide continuity with the rest of Old Mill Park, Manson Parks has just agreed, again with another agreement, to maintain the grounds in front of the boating club. This agreement, in our view, is symbolic of the partnership between the PUD, Manson Parks and Recreation District, and the Lake Chelan Boating Club by preserving and protecting the site's paramount purpose, which is public recreation, number one, and access to the Lake Chelan Hydro Project waters. So we'd be happy to answer any questions.
I don't have questions, but I have a whole bunch of comments, so I'll wait if you want to take questions first.
Steve, do you have any questions?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay. Gary? No? Ann?
Well, I am going to say congratulations. I think these guys deserve a hand, seriously. That is quite an accomplishment. This whole arrangement, this whole situation goes back many years. I'm glad Steve Bikebus is here. Because he's probably the only living person who really knows.
I'm old.
History.
Thanks, Dan. I'm old. I will remind you we're classmates.
Now you're getting in trouble.
Yeah,
because we all graduated the same year, I believe. So
the history is really important. And in the resolution, it talks about this at times being a contentious issue, and it absolutely was. I mean, there were years ago, there were promises made. And, you know, on both sides, and the people who made the promises or the people who heard the promises are, for the most part, no longer alive. So it's been really difficult to sort all of this out and, you know, really get to the facts of what really happened. And I said it was contentious in the past. It certainly isn't anymore. And my absolute thank you and kudos to Jeff Smith and to Steve. What a great working relationship. I'm guessing that these are the two that got this done, that made this happen. And the difficulty was that the boat club, and you hear what the boat club has done for the community and for the lake. I mean, it's phenomenal. We actually, my husband and I had the property on this side of, see, here's the boat club right here. So we actually developed this and the little boat slip here. So I'm down here a lot. And there are, I can attest to the fact that there are groups in there using that club all the time. And that's what they need to do. They have to appear to FERC, to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, to be, have public access and to be a public benefit. And they absolutely are. And that doesn't even speak to all the projects they've done up the lake, up by the up at Lucerne and at campgrounds all along the lake. So anyway, important to get this done. And the club really couldn't move forward and do the kinds of things that you know, we were telling them, the PUD was telling them, you need to have safe docks, you need to have liability insurance. Well, if it becomes a public facility, then the boat club couldn't afford to pay for the insurance. And there were just these catch-22s that just, you know, just always seemed to get in the way for years of getting something that's workable. You know, I mean, you guys needed a longer-term lease so you could make the investment and raise the money and do the things that you were told you had to do. So it's been really...
It's a lot of deferred maintenance that we've put off over the past several years, that 5 years probably, that will now allow us to proceed.
Yeah. So anyway, I want to thank Jeff. Jeff, you pushed this thing through. And I don't know how you did it, but thank you so much. And Steve, between the two of you, it's really important. It's important for the lake, for the club members, for important for the PUD to finally bring this to some sort of a conclusion that works.
Thank you.
Yeah, just a very similar comment that, you know, just to be honest, when I heard this negotiation was coming up, I thought, oh, wow. The next thing I heard was that it was over, and it was an agreeable process. And again, I appreciate the common sense strength approach that both of you brought to the table, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, I have an opportunity, just as a ratepayer, constituent, customer, whatever you want to call us, I'd like to thank you folks for where you're headed, debt reduction, capital improvement, record-breaking year, if I'm not mistaken, coming up. And, and doing that at a time when some pricing issues in the next 4, 5, 6 years are not known. So I think, particularly in the debt reduction area and whatnot, I'm kind of a student of the public utility district. My mom used to be, in fact, a secretary to this body and whatnot years ago. But nonetheless, thank you.
Yeah. What was your mother's name?
Shirley Bykwist.
Yeah. Well, and I thank you. As I 12 years ago as a rookie commissioner, you treated me well when you interviewed me. Never stuck me. But got good information, and
I was throwing softballs, or
no, you were just you understood. You had a rookie on the other end of the line, and treated me with respect, and I still remember it and appreciate it.
Thank you.
Gave me a chance to grow.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jeff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You bet.
Okay, so you want to go back to 16?
We have 11. 11.
Okay.
So item 11 is a resolution approving a request for proposal number 18-33 for general contractor construction management services and authorizing the general manager of the district to publish notice inviting sealed proposals for said project. Recall, this is the issue that we discussed at the last board meeting, and rather than go through that presentation again, we'll just give you an update as to what's happened in the last 2 weeks. Dan Frazier, Sam Dilley will present.
Thanks. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
Sam Dilley, Project Manager.
So today I'd like to give you...
I should have known when both of you on the same day show up with ties on that what's up.
Absolutely.
I just didn't put that...
We're coming to talk.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, gentlemen.
Well, thank you. So today we want to give the board an update of what happened since our last meeting 2 weeks ago. We'll discuss the resolution that's before you for action today, and if approved, what our schedule will be going forward. So subsequent to the we call it a head nod, I think is the technical term we use, of support for the staff to pursue the GCCM, the General Contractor Construction Manager designation from the state's Project Review Committee, the team, which is Sam Dilley, Katie Yunt, myself, and TCF Architects and Parametrics Construction Management, presented to the PRC on the 22nd of the month and of March, and we received unanimous approval for our application. It was an interesting process, our first one at the district, and a lot of eye-opening, what they're looking for, a lot of understanding about why the process is there, and how our project really fit well. The chair of the committee called it a slam dunk, and it's kind of nice to have that when you're first time the rookie at the table, and one of the parting shots was, well, this is kind of a slam dunk for us. So that was nice. So we got that approval, actually got the final official approval by mail last week. So with that, we have the final hurdle really is coming to this board and asking for approval to get an RFP on the street, a request for proposals. So the resolution you have before you today is to issue that request for proposals from the general contractor community. We already know this is there's quite a bit of interest in the in this project throughout the state. We've been talking about it for a while, and our team has been hearing from some of the larger contractors in the state that they're interested. So we are expecting to have a good response to this proposal. We note in the resolution that we already have the approval from the PRC, so this is what would be the next thing to do. If the resolution is approved today, our schedule going forward is that on Friday we would issue the RFP. It would be out for 2 weeks. We'd receive those proposals on the 20th and open them, and we have a district team of five voting members who would review and rank those proposals. We would then do interviews the week of May 14th. And it's an interesting process. You actually issue what's called an RFFP, Request for Final Proposals. So of that shortlisted group, we would ask that they bring their final proposal back to us. Those would be due on May 25th, and then we'd rank and rate those and make a selection. Plan on being back here June 18th for a presentation to the board. A resolution to award and execute agreements would be on the first meeting in July, which I believe now is the 9th. Is that correct?
Yes.
So that would be our schedule going forward if the resolution is approved today. It's ambitious, but it is doable, and this would get us underway at Rock Island. And so at the July 9th meeting, what that would be is a contract only for the Rock Island portion, although we would be selecting the GC for both the Rock Island and Rocky Reach projects. So just any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
I don't know. This is horrible, but I don't really understand, and I've read about this, but how this is different. Can you tell me really in just a few short words how this process is different than what we've done in the past?
Absolutely. This is what we normally use is called design bid build. So we design it. Our staff or a consultant designs it. We put a contract on the street, and that tells all the information, specifications. It tells what materials and everything has all been predetermined. And then the contractor bids that price, and then we enter into a contract and we build it. In this process, we are selecting a contractor partner on qualifications and price, not just price. So we bring some on board that can help us through the design process. So we bring them on at like 20% design. And they help us go through and do the value engineering and all the materials evaluation, constructability reviews, all those kind of things. We do that through the process. And then they go out and get small subcontract bids. And we build the project with our partner being involved in the design. Frequently, you'll hear change orders that a contractor says, well, you bid it this way, but I think I can do it better if I could do it this way. Well, that's a change to the contract, and it's costly. Even if you're saving money, sometimes that's a costly process. That takes that out, so the contractor is involved early on through the initial design. So you don't go one direction, and then once you get a contractor on board, you change. Yeah. So it's a collaborative process.
That explains it. Very good. Okay. I mean, I just the way you put that makes sense. So are other utilities, other folks are going to this kind of a process?
Yeah, we are the first public utility district to do the GCCM. However, Grant County Public Works just this past year completed what's called a progressive design build. A little different process, but a similar partnering with your, there are so many, individual differences between these about five or six different alternative methods of delivery. But this one is very fitting for facilities. The one they did is more fitting for the substation project that they did. But we just visited with them last week, got their lessons learned, and very, very similar process in how they selected and what they did going forward. And there's a lot of lessons learned that are applicable for how we're going to operate here.
Thanks.
Commissioner, I'd like to add one more thing. I think Dan did a great job describing how the process is different. I'd like to describe for a moment how the outcome is different. So the current process is really set up to try to get least front-end cost, the bid cost for the thing, make that the lowest cost possible. What we're shooting for is what's up on the wall, best for the most for the longest. And what this process gives us the opportunity is to look for least life cycle cost with highest quality associated with it. And that's the fundamental difference and reason why we want to go down this path of looking at innovative contracting mechanisms.
Makes sense.
Any other thoughts, questions? Thank you. Sam is happy.
Commissioner, I'd like to suggest that we skip over item 13 for a second, and we will come back to that one.
Okay.
And hit item 14, which is a resolution approving the agreement reached pursuant to labor negotiations with Local Number 77 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers for the period April 1st, 2018 through March 31st, 2021. Lorna Klemanski will be presenting.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Lorna Klemanski, Managing Director of Human Resources, Labor and Safety. And today, Odell and I are seeking your approval of the tentative agreement on our collective bargaining agreement that was ratified by IBEW Local 77 membership. It's for a three-year term with 3% general wage increases on April 1st of each year. It includes some changes on health care cost sharing, changes to comply with recent state law, and it adds past letters of understanding to the body of the agreement. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Commissioners?
Good work.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve?
No questions.
All right. Again, thank you. Appreciate everybody's effort, both sides of the table, and coming together and reaching an equitable agreement and everybody's work in a nice spirit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I suggest having approval of the agenda to this point, and we take item 13 separately.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of resolutions 11 and 14 as presented.
Second. It's been moved and seconded to accept resolutions 11 and 14 as presented. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of resolutions 11 and 14 signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion's carried. Thank you all.
Okay, I want to come back to item 13. Item 13 is a confirming resolution for the moratorium on high-density loads, virtual cryptocurrency mining. And let me take a second and just read that, and then we have a suggestion for an additional motion to add to this. This is a resolution ratifying and confirming the adoption of a moratorium and establishing policies for enforcing the moratorium on electric service applications for computing and data processing loads related to virtual or cryptocurrency mining, Bitcoin, or similar purposes. Eric Walquist will describe that. And then based on the information that we heard this morning regarding the unauthorized high-density load, we want to suggest an addition of actions that we'll be taking immediately to respond to the concerns that have been heard there. So, Eric, would you please take over from here?
Sure. Thanks, Steve. So, Commissioners, the title really says it all. This is simply the resolution that the board directed staff to bring forward today as part of the motion that was made and passed unanimously at the last board meeting for a resolution ratifying and confirming the adoption of the moratorium and the setting of the public hearing on that moratorium for any modification, extension, or cessation for March 14th at the board's regular scheduled board meeting. I say that with hesitancy only because I think we changed that date, actually. So it is March 14th, May 14th, sorry. So you'll see if you reviewed your packet that there are some instructions or some enforcement policies that have been set out in this resolution. This is a bit different than the moratorium we did last time. We didn't actually interpose or have a confirming resolution for the last moratorium. This one, we proposed to do that simply so that it could carry some of the instruction from the board to staff as to how to apply the moratorium. Moratorium serves two purposes primarily. First is it does push the pause button on these types of loads, which are discrete, distinctly different from what I would call historic rate classifications, and gives us the time to develop policies, programs, and pricing for service of these loads prior to the institution of said service. So having said that, it is also recognized that a lot of these folks are very bright, they're very creative, and they tend to take issue with words in the moratorium or words in the motion when staff is speaking to them. And I've heard services proposed and described as deep thinking data processing, as engineering data processing. So anything at all to avoid cryptocurrency, virtual currency, or those types of uses. And so some of this simply recognizes that it's impossible for staff to really get in and see the work that these machines are doing, and just acknowledges that staff needs to apply its expertise, its experience, and its reason when we're trying to determine whether a proposed load is or is not subject to the moratorium. And then while I was having my turkey sandwich at lunch, Steve had suggested that maybe given the conversation today, it would be beneficial to have some further instruction from the board about the enforcement of the moratorium, the discouragement of the unauthorized loads, and what staff might need to do to ensure that to the greatest extent we can protect not only the district and its assets to include the pricing and the rates and other ratepayers, but also the public health safety concerns associated with unauthorized loads. Whether, frankly, they're knowing or unknowing, the risks are often the same. So to that end, I have given you a proposed motion which would not only ratify the moratorium and approve the proposed resolution, but also give staff some instruction in terms of, enforcing all the currently available. You heard the update this morning about some additional mechanisms to be proposed and adopted at the next board meeting if the board is so inclined. But we do have some remedies available in the current regulations that staff can impose, and so this motion does provide that instruction. It also includes disconnection of service, as we heard occurred last Friday and has been occurring periodically, and frankly gives staff the confidence that the board is supportive of such action, even though that action has long been established as a right under the district service regulations. Sometimes staff is reluctant to execute those if they know that the first thing that will happen is a commissioner will get a phone call or something of that nature. And then so it does reaffirm that, and then it provides instruction to staff as appropriate to report either for public health safety concerns or theft reasons associated with avoidance for paying for energy to law enforcement or the other appropriate authorities.
Ann?
So, Eric, so does this resolution replace this one?
No. So what you have is a motion approving the resolution, which is why we took the matter separately. So it would
So we'd approve the resolution first.
So are you looking at the email?
Sorry.
I sent? Yeah. So
the original resolution.
You should have an email in front of you.
And I have that. And I have this.
So if you read that email, as opposed to simply approving the resolution, which this does, it adds the additional instruction to staff. So I think the motion is made and adopted, then you will have the effect of adopting this resolution, confirming the moratorium, and providing the additional direction or guidance to staff.
Well, that's what I thought. So would you like us to read, but I think it might be important to read the original resolution.
So Steve read the title to the original resolution.
Okay. So
all that.
I move to approve resolution number 13, then.
If you read what I typed you in the email, it will approve 13 and
right.
provide the additional guidance.
Okay. And so you don't want us to read the actual wording of the original resolution for the record?
No.
All right.
If I understand your question.
Yeah.
All we need is the motion approving the resolution and providing the additional guidance.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I will move to approve Resolution 13, ratifying the moratorium on cryptocurrency mining and directing staff to take all reasonable steps to enforce the moratorium and prevent unauthorized mining activities, including, number one, imposing all available fees and penalties, number two, disconnecting service, and number three, referring unauthorized loads to law enforcement and other authorities as appropriate.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Been moved and seconded. Discussion?
Dennis, this is Steve.
Yes, please.
Just my comments regarding the resolution is I, as one commissioner, and we'll soon be voting on this, I think it's important to send the message out as a commission that not only are we concerned, we're incensed with the idea that individuals are placing individuals in Chelan County at risk, either through theft or possibility of fire, and we're not going to tolerate that. This is a strong message. And I just want to make that very, very clear.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. Any other questions, comments, Steve?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. One of my, the only concern I have regarding the modified motion that we have in front of us is that it refers specifically to cryptocurrency, whereas blockchain, which essentially processes, in a simplified statement, processes the same and utilizes the same level of energy, is not identified here. So let's say you had a person who decided to bypass our process to set up blockchain and create the same hazard, I don't see being covered here. Is that?
So I think that it is, Commissioner. I think that your motion merely approves the resolution, and the resolution is sufficiently broad to include that.
Okay. So, in again, combining the former specific 13 with this one, your
famous
attorney covers both.
Yeah, so this is nothing more than the motion that you would normally make to approve resolutions 1 through 6.
Okay.
The only difference is in addition to approving 1 through 6, or in this case 13, it also provides some additional guidance to staff.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, so I'm in agreement with Dennis here. I think it's important we make it really, really clear what or close all possible loopholes so that, you know, in our statement to the public, everybody, it was very, very clear. What was included? So, do you think we're covered?
I think it's sufficiently broad.
Yeah. The last three words or similar.
Yes.
Purposes.
Right. And so that's part of the reason for the instruction in the resolution proper to staff to apply its experience and reason is because we hear every possible reclassification or description of what's being done to take it outside of what would otherwise be the moratorium, and so. We do indeed apply that reason and will not serve those loads without further board action. The next opportunity for the board to contemplate that is the 14th of May. So, yes, I'm satisfied that it is sufficiently broad with the motion as written.
I think you've spelled it out pretty well on the resolution on the second page, giving the illustrative purposes. It's you've cast your net pretty wide.
Intentionally so.
Yeah.
So if you're happy, I'm happy.
That always makes me happy, Commissioner.
All right. There's a lot of happiness happening here. So. Okay.
Borderline glee.
I do have one point,
yes,
just
please.
A point of clarification.
Yeah.
Just in terms of any future fines that staff might arrive at, here it says imposing all available fees and penalties. So does that contemplate staff coming up with a separate set or a different set of fees?
So I think you heard this morning that that's under evaluation and probably for presentation under proposal at the next board meeting.
The
language is written broadly enough that it would include the currently available fees and charges as well as any future fees and charges that might be adopted by the board, as you heard this morning. And we will make sure that it is clear with the adoption of those that that is the intent.
So that'll come back to the board?
Yes. Okay. I think I heard this morning in 2 weeks.
Okay. Thank you.
With no seemingly additional comments, commissioners, those in favor of the motion as presented, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. So now 16.
Thank you. Now we're ready for 16,
thank
yes.
You.
So there's been a fair amount of work that's gone into thinking through shoreline management plan, and in particular, how we would engage the public if we face other issues associated with shoreline plan management. And so I'm going to ask Eric to address this issue for a moment under manager items, and then we have some visitors I think we're going to call up as well.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. I don't want to step on your feet. Tika and Jenna, do you have something you were proposing to present? Okay, hearing no objection. You never let the lawyer have an open mic. So, commissioners, yes, I'd like to acknowledge Mike and Karen Wade, who are here. I let them know that this would be coming forward under manager items a little slower, frankly, than I had hoped. Initially, I think we contemplated a different timeline, but it's taken a bit of time to get this far because of competing interests here at the district, which you are all well aware of, and then also the need, as directed by this board, to populate committee members from different areas, all areas of the county. So, this is a representative issue, and it was the commitment that the board made to the county commissioners as part of the conversation about the shoreline management plan and the proposed adoption of different undergrounding requirements. We have, as a result of that commitment, I shouldn't take credit, really Tika and Jenna with Andy's guidance and some input from John and I, mostly staying out of the way. Developed a charter, populated most of a community advisory committee to include the Wades. We still have some outstanding board members have proposed names as well, and we've reached out to those. Commissioner Arsenault, thank you for Commissioner Gutzweiler, and let me know how your fishing trip in Alaska goes, which was his fee. The fact of the matter is that as soon as we complete the populating of that committee, and even sooner if we run into one or two remaining spaces, would be to assemble that group and begin to work on the outreach plan, the development of a good, comprehensive plan, thinking through the issues. One of the complaints that we heard during the public discussion in the shoreline management program, as you're well aware of, is the interest in doing better with respect to outreach to our customer owners and interested groups with respect to facilities in the shoreline. The effort that sort of caused the stir, I think, back in 2014 was some reworking of a distribution line on the south shore of Lake Chelan. And what we heard out of that was that we maybe didn't get it right when we came to reaching out to the right people in terms of populating a completely interested group of individuals. And even if we had not properly scoped the amount of information and alternatives, cost, design, engineering, property rights, the host of issues that go forward in that, to allow the group to, the neighborhood group, to really raise issues like who would pay, how would pay, would they be willing to pay Should this be something that the district foot the bill for? Without those alternatives available for discussion, then they felt a bit uninformed or even bullied over with respect to that project. And my perspective has been it doesn't really matter in hindsight how we think we did. If they didn't think we got it right, we need to try to do better. So that is the effort that the board committed to, and we're about ready to launch that effort and just wanted to do a check-in. In terms of the scope, that is the scope. We will develop what I hope will become a model outreach program with some sideboards around the level of outreach that needs to be done, the level of design and communication, the thinking about the alternatives, design, funding, et cetera, engineering. Frankly, my hope is that it will become a model for how we do some of the outreach that we're trying to work through on a timeline. And that reserves all of the decision-making issues, all of the policy issues, the final design, final construction, final contracting, the final financial, who pays, how pays. All of those issues are reserved to the board on pretty much either a case-by-case, project-by-project basis, or in the event that there's a larger policy decision made by the board as part of a larger policy decision. But my hope is that this process will lead us to a place that there is alignment between staff and customers as to the proposed alternative. And frankly, where there is not alignment, as I suspect will occasionally occur, there is sufficient information on both sides, staff's proposal and the community perspective, that you can have some considered and reasoned presentations by not just staff, but also community members as to why they might find a different path than staff is proposing. Have I forgotten anything? Either of you? No? John, anything? Andy, anything to add? So with that, commissioners, I'm happy to answer questions, but I would really like to invite the Wades, if they have a different or same perspective, to say so. They've been patiently, I think, awaiting us getting this effort started and have provided names, and we're still looking at those names and trying to reach out to do some populating of the committee. So thanks, Mike.
Yeah, and Mike, generally we ask the person to state their name and their residential address, and because our meetings are recorded, and that gives the public the opportunity to understand who's speaking with them.
Sure. Yeah, my name's Mike Wade. I live at 1401 Fielding Hills Drive in East Wenatchee. We also own property, several properties along Lake Chelan. And that's obviously the issue. So this kind of feels like the hot seat I'm sitting in.
Yeah.
This one's the hot seat, Mike. Trust me.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. No, I think Eric summarized it well. My little slant, I think, and the community slant, if I can maybe speak a little bit broader, is that I'm hoping that we can engage you guys to understand that this needs to, I think, have a different policy look at it as well. I think that the power poles that are there and the options to put them underground, I think it needs to be a broader shared expense consideration as well. Because there was that whole process that Eric described about going through the county effort and was a real eye-opener. And I don't want to bore you with too much history, but I know I was really struggling with the interpretation of the law. And to me, I still think, if a layman reads the law, you can't expand the nonconformity. But as Eric pointed out, okay, that's, for the moment, let's agree that that's the case. We can't do it. That still doesn't address who's going to pay for it. So even if it had to go underground, most likely it would have been, again, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it's been now, it would have been that corridor of power users that would have been facing the bill. I'd like to think we can include in this discussion that we're about to have is that really appropriate? Because as the Shoreline Management Act speaks to, it's the public benefit of the view corridor and things like that, that it's not only the adjacent property owners, it truly is the public. So I guess I want to kind of preload that into your head that I hope we can address that in a, because as all the ratepayers know, you are the guys that have all the money, so. Maybe we can spin this into an Exhibit R thing or something, too. But really do appreciate the time and effort, some of the memorandum from Eric. It's kind of interesting to see how you guys have to go about your business, and it's obviously going to be a very thorough, well-thought-out process. So I don't know if my wife has anything to add or not.
Thank you, Mike. So I'll just follow up and say I've spent a lot of time with both Mike and Karen, who are very interested, have taken a lot of their own time to read and understand the issues, and they've spent a lot of time with me and other staff. So I'm going to say that I've told them that the primary concern or issue commitment of this effort is to work on the outreach to make sure we get it right, and they're always welcome to try to convince you to change your policy level statement about growth paying for growth and reevaluate those. So if they come armed at some point in time with information that they've learned of this process to make that pitch to you, that's fine. Those policy decisions at this point are left with the board. Current policy is growth pays for growth. If there's a reason to change that, I'm sure that they and or staff will make that suggestion to you. I will say that despite the possibility of a point of divergence there regarding whether this process is intended to include that or not, they're always welcome to bring it. And I will tell you that I think that the perspective that they brought is very reasoned. For example, and Mike mentioned it, there are areas where you might suggest that undergrounding would be appropriate for aesthetic or other reasons. And I think they've even acknowledged there are, if there's money to be spent, potentially locations where we're in the riparian zone where it would not be necessarily appropriate to spend those extra dollars underground. So always interested. I'm actually looking forward to the conversation and the perspective. And I actually want to thank, again, Deacon Jenna for taking it on. It's a big lift. With your blessing, we'll move to the next step.
Any comments or questions by commissioners?
Did that change anything? You want to come back to say something? No.
I'd just like to thank Karen and Mike for your input, and always have an open door. If you ever have any questions or you want to present something as one commissioner, feel free. You've got my number. Call me.
And I should say that it's not just me. There have been a lot of staff involved in this. Steve's taken time, John's taken time, and even Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner Smith took time to meet. So I appreciate that.
And I'd just like to reiterate what Gary just said.
If I could just throw one quick caveat on this, and I'm pretty sure the Wades know that we walked into this year with a performance plan expecting to do a whole bunch of work, and we are finding ourselves diverted pretty substantially dealing with loads. And so just if you can be understanding of the fact that we didn't anticipate the work that we're having to do. You heard some of that discussion today. We spent probably a good 45 minutes this morning in a board meeting dealing with the same issue. That none of this was in our work plan for this year. So just appreciate your forbearance. As we try to work through that.
Yep. And empathetically, I would guess with a tariff imposed by China on the food industry, your workload just changed as well. So it's an understanding that I think we all have in the same community. So thank you very much for helping us out. Appreciate it.
That's all I have. Thanks.
All right.
Okay. The next item, we wanted to talk a little bit about the Sage Hills and the update. I want to invite Don Pope to come on up and discuss that.
Good afternoon, commissioners. Von Pope, senior wildlife biologist for the district. And as you're aware, this Saturday, much of the Sage Hills opened up for recreational use. Slam Beauty owns and operates the 960-acre Home Water Preserve, which has a 2.2-mile section of trail. Of that whole Sage Hills Trail. And then that Home Water Preserve is a FERC wildlife mitigation parcel designated for mule deer winter range. So the trail opened a day early this year. We have this first time we've actually ever opened it early, but it was so it was one day early. And it was actually fairly, it was pretty convenient given the current conditions we have. But this was the 11th anniversary of that opening, so we've been doing this now for 11 years, and so what I've put up here is just one simple graph that shows the red line is the average number of deer counts. We do deer counts during this winter closure weekly, for us to understand whether or not this is having the benefit that the district has been given the need to maintain it for, which is the mule deer. So what you see there is the red line is the 10-year average from the winter of 2007 and 2008 up to 2016 and 2017, and then the blue line is the 2017-18 winter deer counts. So this year was not much different on average. There's generally some peaks and valleys in this whole thing, depending on when the snow comes and how deep it is. The deer numbers bounce around a bit, but overall, we're seeing basically an average number of deer through this winter compared to previous winters, which is a good thing given that we've had fires and at least one hard winter in the last 5 years. So overall, things look pretty good.
Any comments, questions? You know, Vaughn, a couple of weeks ago, I shared with you that I watch the herd on Skyline. And I noticed after a couple of weeks that guys had just weren't showing up on time, and I was missing them. And it finally dawned on me that they don't have daylight savings time. It wasn't the deer at all. If I adjusted my schedule, they're there and doing well and looking pretty sleek, actually, for early season. But yeah, it was just kind of one of those where it's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, the important thing, I think, that it's hard, but it's really, we really appreciate the relationship we have with the Chelan Douglas Land Trust closing their opposite ends of us. We don't own trailheads. They do. They own and operate in them and the city both. So it's through their cooperation that we're able to get the closure. And you can see that March is basically our biggest month. So, and that's when people tend to get cabin fever and want to get out. And in some winters, that's really can put a stress on the deer moving around. At this particular stage in late winter, early spring, there's enough areas in the foothills for them to go get away from some of that recreational impact, potentially have forage, cover, all that. If it happened to be a lot of snow, we might be having a different conversation.
Yeah.
Have any of our guys been up the lake? Have they
Yes.
seen any goats?
Yeah, we've been we've done our 11 and a half winter wildlife surveys on Lake Chelan. On Friday, we tried to conduct our 12th, and we only got halfway up before the wind.
Windy.
Before the wind got the better of us.
Yeah.
So, and the goat numbers have, from what we're seeing, declined. But that's not necessarily indicative of what may be out there, because boat surveys are somewhat limited in what they can and can't see, particularly in mild winters. Those goats might not come down. You might not be able to see them. So.
Where do you see them? I haven't seen any for years.
Well, the lowest we see them is above Deer Point, across on the south shore. From there up to Bear Creek, almost to Domkey.
On the south shore?
On the south shore, yeah. And then from Safety Harbor up to typically around Prince Creek, and occasionally right around Stehekin itself.
But they're up pretty high, aren't they?
They have been. They basically taxed every objective power of our binoculars to get out there and find them. They've been hanging out in the high stuff. Every once in a while, we find them down low. But these last couple winters, it seems like they've just hung out in the high country.
What's your count? I mean, a rough count.
We're working on the report now. I think the most we saw in any count would be in the neighborhood of 45 or 50. Years past, we've seen over 100 in a single count. We are looking at some options going forward in the Lake Chelan Winter Wildlife, Lake Chelan Wildlife Plan, to perhaps do the surveys a little differently and with cooperation of DFW and perhaps through their efforts get a little more information, either confirm what we're seeing or basically come up with a better survey that might indicate that the goats are still there. Mm-hmm. They're just not that observable.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We are done with manager items.
Okay. Commission items? Hearing none. Commissioner Travel? He's on our way. Okay. Well, let's.
We can do the delegation.
Let's go on the delegation. Okay.
Yeah. Wait till Lisa comes back. We actually have quite a few. We caught up some this past 2 weeks, I'm happy to say. First of all, we had one on shoreline management plan. You just heard that one, so we've managed to take care of that. We had a request that we add electrical load growth to the next Tri-Commission meeting, so Jeff Smith got that one. The Tri-Commission meeting will be on June 5th, and that agenda item will be included. We have a follow-up on Arondo Park, particularly with respect to where we're going for future years. We are developing those options. We expect to bring that to you in the May meeting. We've had an initial staff meeting on that and are working through the issues there. There was a request for additional information on the contractor safety program. We intend to bring that to you in one of the two June board meetings. The issue of options for increasing the board designated reserve fund we dealt with earlier today. The issue of how did the insurance proceeds work on lost generation and hydro projects? You heard that one earlier today. Issue of Commissioner Arsenault and Commissioner McKenna's interest in going to the Skaha Hatchery. There is an option available to you, as I understand it, for May 2nd. So you'll be working with Aline Underwood on whether you're able to take advantage of that opportunity or not. There was a request for a summary of the carbon tax initiative, which was actually filed with the state since our last board meeting. Tracy Dunt has sent a summary of that to you. Hopefully you've received that. And Eric was looking into the issue of high-density loads and whether they can be prosecuted or not, and that information has been provided to you as well. So I think we're mostly caught up, other than we've identified some items that will be coming back at future board meetings.
Okay.
I show on my calendar, I show the Tri-Commission meeting June 5th at 11 a.m. Is that, it's 1 p.m., isn't it? 1, yeah. I am put it wrong. Yeah.
What date?
June 5th. June 5th.
And I think, Lisa, we are ready for you. Come on up.
Oh, really?
Hey, I'm Lisa, the finance and admin, and I'm here to go over your travel arrangements. And I got several hotels all booked up through end of December with the annual conference. I don't know where that is yet. And does anyone attend the Public Power Council?
We
December?
We no. Never have.
No.
So I should probably take this off.
At least for now. Yeah.
Take it off.
Yeah.
Lisa, do you have us at the DoubleTree? That's what
yeah.
You do. I thought I saw Commissioner Bowles wanting to be at the.
He is.
The other one.
He is.
Yeah. Okay.
She's taking care of you.
But you know what? I need a lot of help.
So. Don't we all?
Gratefully accepted.
So.
And I think, Lisa, I asked you to scratch me from the April Association, State Association meetings.
Yes.
Yes, Mahomish. Okay.
I have that. And in November, I think, is the next meeting in Olympia, and I have Dennis at Commissioner Bowles.
Oh, sorry. Town Place.
Mm-hmm. At Town Place.
It was Dennis before I was commissioner, so that's quite all right.
Well, yeah. I slipped.
Okay. I'll let it happen again.
And I think I just need a registration from Commissioner Bowles for NWPPA.
Yep,
I think that's in your office.
With me. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll bring it to you after the meeting today.
Have your expense book.
Well, that's a good point. No.
I just.
But it'll be.
We want you to get paid too.
It'll be here tomorrow.
Jeez. Thank
you.
See how
much help you need. Yeah.
And I was wondering. Sorry. So, is Commissioner Smith on the phone?
No, Commissioner Smith.
Never mind. Oh, Commissioner. Okay.
Oh, yeah, McKenna. Sorry.
So, we don't have anyone attending the Water Committee?
June 28th. I don't know if I will be able to go. If I don't go over, I'll call in.
Oh, okay.
And Ron Slabaugh usually goes. We were both at the last one this last week.
Okay, so we don't need a replacement.
No. Okay. I'll keep you posted on that. Thanks for checking, though.
Mm-hmm. And I think Commissioner Smith, is he the only one that will go to the Budget Committee meeting?
Yeah, I think so.
Only, okay. And then I just have Commissioner Congdon and Commissioner Smith attending the September water workshop.
I think that's correct. I'm speaking for myself, but.
Well, that helps. Helps.
One last.
Yeah. Confirms one. Do you still plan attending that, Commissioner Congdon?
Yes.
Okay.
That's a good workshop.
I believe Commissioner Smith plans to attend as well. So is there anything you need from me or any questions?
I'm good.
Okay.
Thanks. You and I talked this morning about the April 18 meeting over in Snohomish. I'll be going on the 17th, but coming back on the 19th.
Yes. Okay. That'll be updated.
All right.
Okay. Any other items? I'll see you after the meeting.
Perfect. Thanks.
Great.
And tomorrow with the blue book. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thanks, Lisa.
One hates to run afoul with staff.
Well, especially the staff that pays you.
Well, I know.
So I think we're up to the follow-up on action items from this board meeting, and we did not record any today. Did we miss any questions that you had for us to follow up on?
I think we're good.
I don't believe so.
Any other additional public comment? Matters of general business? Hearing none, we will recess this meeting and move into executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I for approximately
60
minutes. So we'll take a 5-minute break and come back and start at 2:15. With that, we'll recess.
All right.
Did we miss this?
Pardon me?
Did we miss this?
No. We're going to do it next meeting.
Yeah, we changed.
Oh,
okay, this is Lyon County Board of Commissioners coming out of executive session. It is now 3:12 in the afternoon. No decisions were reached, no votes were taken. And if there's no other cause to continue meeting, we are adjourned.